The fever's broken.
Randall Thor, Rand whispered. Matt nodded, and there was something so comforting in it that Rand drifted off to sleep without even touching the water. It was a sleep untroubled by dreams, at least by any he remembered, but light enough that his eyes drifted open whenever Matt checked on him. Once he wondered if Matt was getting any sleep at all, but he fell back asleep himself before the thought got very far. The squeal of the door hinges roused him fully, but for a moment he only lay there in the hay, wishing he was still asleep. Asleep, he would not be aware of his body. His muscles ached like wrung-out rags and had about as much strength. Weakly, he tried to raise his head. He made it on the second try. Matt sat in his accustomed place against the wall, within arm's reach of Rand. His chin rested on his chest, which rose and fell in the easy rhythm of deep sleep. The scarf had slipped down over his eyes. Rand looked toward the door. A woman stood there, holding it open with one hand. For a moment, she was only a dark shape in a dress, outlined by the faint light of early morning. Then she stepped inside, letting the door swing shut behind her. In the lantern light, he could see her more clearly. She was about the same age as Nynaeve, he thought, but she was no village woman. The pale green silk of her dress shimmered as she moved. Her cloak was a rich, soft gray, and a frothy net of lace caught up her hair. She fingered a heavy gold necklace as she looked thoughtfully at Matt and him.
Matt, Rand said, then louder. Matt!
Matt snorted and almost fell over as he came awake. Scrubbing sleep from his eyes, he stared at the woman.
I came to look at my horse, she said, gesturing vaguely at the stalls.
She never took her eyes away from the two of them, though.
Are you ill?
He's all right, Matt said stiffly. He just caught a chill in the rain, that's all.
Perhaps I should look at him, she said. I have some knowledge.
Rand wondered if she were Aes Sedai.
Even more than her clothes, her self-assured manner, the way she held her head as if on the point of giving a command, did not belong here.
And if she is Aes Sedai, of what Aja?
I'm fine now, he told her. Really, there's no need.
But she came down the length of the stable, holding her skirt up and placing her gray slippers gingerly. With a grimace for the straw, she knelt beside him and felt his forehead.
No fever, she said, studying him with a frown.
She was pretty in a sharp-featured fashion, but there was no warmth in her face. It was not cold, either. It just seemed to lack any feeling whatsoever.
You were sick, though. Yes, yes. And still weak as a day-old kitten. I think...
She reached under her cloak, and suddenly things were happening too fast for Rand to do more than give a strangled shout. Her hand flashed from under her cloak. Something glittered as she lunged across Rand toward Matt. Matt toppled sideways in a flurry of motion, and there was a solid t-chunk of metal driven into wood. It all took just an instant, and then everything was still. Matt lay half on his back, one hand gripping her wrist, just above the dagger she had driven into the wall where his chest had been, his other hand holding the blade from Shadar Logoth to her throat. Moving nothing but her eyes, she tried to look down at the dagger Matt held. Eyes widening, she drew a ragged breath and tried to pull back from it, but he kept the edge against her skin. After that, she was as still as a stone. Licking his lips, Rand stared at the tableau above him. Even if he had not been so weak, he did not believe he could have moved. Then his eyes fell on her dagger, and his mouth went dry. The wood around the blade was blackening. Thin tendrils of smoke rose from the char.
Matt! Matt, her dagger!
Matt flicked a glance at the dagger, then back to the woman, but she had not moved. She was licking her lips nervously. Roughly, Matt pried her hand off the hilt and gave her a push. She toppled back, sprawling away from them and catching herself with her hands behind her, still watching the blade in his hand.
Don't move, he said. I'll use this if you move. Believe me, I will.
She nodded slowly. Her eyes never left Matt's dagger.
Watch her, Rand.
Rand was not sure what he was supposed to do if she tried anything. Shout, maybe. He certainly could not run after her if she tried to flee. But she sat there without twitching while Matt yanked her dagger free of the wall. The black spot stopped growing, though a faint wisp of smoke still trailed up from it.
Matt looked around for somewhere to put the dagger, then thrust it toward Rand. He took it gingerly, as if it were a live adder. It looked ordinary, if ornate, with a pale ivory hilt and a narrow, gleaming blade no longer than the palm of his hand. Just a dagger. Only he had seen what it could do. The hilt was not even warm, but his hand began to sweat. He hoped he did not drop it in the hay. The woman did not move from her sprawl as she watched Matt slowly turn toward her. She watched him, as if wondering what he would do next, but Rand saw the sudden tightening of Matt's eyes, the tightening of his hand on the dagger.
"Matt, no! She tried to kill me, Rand. She'd have killed you, too. She's a dark friend,"
Matt spat the word.
"But we're not," Rand said.
The woman gasped as if she had just realized what Matt had intended.
"We are not, Matt."
For a moment, Matt remained frozen, the blade in his fist catching the lantern light. Then he nodded.
"Move over there,"
he told the woman, gesturing with the dagger toward the door to the tack room. She got to her feet slowly, pausing to brush the straw from her dress. Even when she started in the direction Matt indicated, she moved as if there were no reason to hurry. But Rand noticed that she kept a wary eye on the ruby-hilted dagger in Matt's hand.
"You really should stop struggling," she said. "It would be for the best in the end. You will see."
"The best," Matt said wryly, rubbing his chest where her blade would have gone if he had not moved.
"Get over there."
She gave a casual shrug as she obeyed.
"A mistake. There has been considerable confusion since what happened with that egotistical fool Goad, not to mention whoever the idiot was who started the panic in Market Sharon. No one is sure what happened there or how. That makes it more dangerous for you, don't you see?"
"You will have honored places if you come to the great lord of your own free will. But as long as you run, there will be pursuit. And who can tell what will happen then?"
Rand felt a chill.
"My hounds are jealous and may not be gentle."
"So you're having trouble with a couple of farm boys?"
Matt's laugh was grim.
"Maybe you dark friends aren't as dangerous as I've always heard."
He flung open the door of the tack room and stepped back. She paused just through the doorway, looking at him over her shoulder. Her gaze was ice, and her voice colder still.
"You will find out how dangerous we are when the murderer gets here."
Whatever else she had to say was cut off as Matt slammed the door and pulled the bar down into its brackets. When he turned, his eyes were worried.
"Fade,"
he said in a tight voice, tucking the dagger back under his coat.
"Coming here, she says. How are your legs?"
"I can't dance," Rand muttered. "But if you'll help me get on my feet, I can walk." He looked at the blade in his hand and shuddered.
"Blood and ashes, I'll run."
Hurriedly hanging himself about with their possessions, Matt pulled Rand to his feet. Rand's legs wobbled, and he had to lean on his friend to stay upright, but he tried not to slow Matt down. He held the woman's dagger well away from himself. Outside the door was a bucket of water. He tossed the dagger into it as they passed. The blade entered the water with a hiss. Steam rose from the surface. Grimacing, he tried to take faster steps. With light come, there were plenty of people in the streets, even so early. They were about their own business, though, and no one had any attention to spare for two young men walking out of the village, not with so many strangers about. Just the same, Rand stiffened every muscle, trying to stand straight. With each step, he wondered if any of the folk hurrying by were dark friends. Any of them waiting for the woman with the dagger. For the fade. A mile outside the village, his strength gave out. One minute he was panting along, hanging on Matt. The next, they were both on the ground. Matt tugged him over to the side of the road.
"We have to keep going," Matt said.
He scrubbed his hand through his hair, then tugged the scarf down above his eyes.
"Sooner or later, somebody will let her out, and they'll be after us again."
"I know," Rand panted. "I know. Give me a hand."
Matt pulled him up again, but he wavered there, knowing it was no good. The first time he tried to take a step, he would be flat on his face again. Holding him upright, Matt waited impatiently for a horse cart approaching from the village to pass them. Matt gave a grunt of surprise when the cart slowed to a stop before them. A leathery-faced man looked down from the driver's seat.
"Something wrong with him?" the man asked around his pipe.
"He's just tired," Matt said.
Rand could see that was not going to do, not leaning on Matt the way he was. He let go of Matt and took a step away from him. His legs quivered, but he willed himself to stay erect.
"I haven't slept in 2 days," he said. "Ate something that made me sick. I'm better now, but I haven't slept."
The man blew a streamer of smoke from the corner of his mouth.
"Going to Camlin, are you? Was your age, I expect I might be off to see this false dragon myself."
"Yes," Matt nodded. "That's right. We're going to see the false dragon."
"Yeah, climb on up then. Your friend in the back. If he's sick again, best it's on the straw, not up here. Name's Chaim Kinch."
Chapter 34 The Last Village. It was after dark when they reached Carysford, longer than Rand had thought it would take from what Master Kinch said when he let them down. He wondered if his whole sense of time was getting skewed. Only 3 nights since Howl Goad and 4 Kings, 2 since Pater had surprised them in Market Sharon. Just a bare day since the nameless dark friend woman tried to kill them in the stable of the Queen's Man. But even that seemed a year ago, or a lifetime. Whatever was happening to time, Carysford appeared normal enough, on the surface at least. Neat, vine-covered brick houses in narrow lanes, except for the Camlin Road itself, quiet and outwardly peaceful. But what's underneath, he wondered. Market Sharon had been peaceful to look at, and so had the village where the woman... He had never learned the name of that one, and he did not want to think about it. Light spilled from the windows of the houses into streets all but empty of people. That suited Rand. Slinking from corner to corner, he avoided the few people abroad. Matt stuck to his shoulder, freezing when the crunch of gravel announced the approach of a villager, dodging from shadow to shadow when the dim shape had gone past. The River Carry was a bare 30 paces wide there, and the black water moved sluggishly, but the ford had long since been bridged over. Centuries of rain and wind had worn the stone abutments until they seemed almost like natural formations. Years of freight trains and merchant trains had ground at the thick wooden planks, too. Loose boards rattled under their boots, sounding as loud as drums. Until long after they were through the village and into the countryside beyond, Rand waited for a voice to demand to know who they were. Or worse, knowing who they were. The countryside had been filling up the further they went, becoming more and more settled. There were always the lights of farmhouses in sight. Hedges and rail fences lined the road and the fields beyond. Always the fields were there, and never a stretch of woods close to the road. It seemed as if they were always on the outskirts of a village, even when they were hours from the nearest town. Neat and peaceful, and with never an indication that dark friends or worse might be lurking. Abruptly, Matt sat down in the road. He had pushed the scarf up on top of his head, now that the only light came from the moon.
2 paces to the span, he muttered. 1,000 spans to the mile. 4 miles to the league. I'm not walking another 10 paces unless there's a place to sleep at the end of it. Something to eat wouldn't be amiss either. You haven't been hiding anything in your pockets, have you? An apple, maybe? I won't hold it against you if you have. You could at least look.
Rand peered down the road both ways. They were the only things moving in the night. He glanced at Matt, who had pulled off one boot and was rubbing his foot. Or they had been. His own feet hurt, too. A tremor ran up his legs, as if to tell him he had not yet regained as much strength as he thought. Dark mounds stood in a field just ahead of them. Haystacks diminished by winter feeding, but still haystacks. He nudged Matt with his toe.
We'll sleep there. Haystacks again.
Matt sighed, but he tugged on his boot and got up. The wind was rising, the night chill growing deeper. They climbed over the smooth poles of the fence and quickly were burrowing into the hay. The tarp that kept the rain off the hay cut the wind, too. Rand twisted around in the hollow he had made until he found a comfortable position. Hay still managed to poke at him through his clothes, but he had learned to put up with that. He tried counting the haystacks he had slept in since Whitebridge. Heroes in the stories never had to sleep in haystacks or under hedges, but it was not easy to pretend anymore that he was a hero in a story, even for a little while. With a sigh, he pulled his collar up in the hopes of keeping hay from getting down his back.
"Rand," Matt said softly. "Rand, do you think we'll make it? Tar Valon? It's a long way yet, but... Camelin? Do you think we'll make it to Camelin?"
Rand raised his head, but it was dark in their burrow. The only thing that told him where Matt was his voice.
"Master Kinch said 2 days. Day after tomorrow, the next day, we'll get there. If there aren't 100 dark friends waiting for us down the road, or a fate or two..."
There was silence for a moment, then Matt said,
"I think we're the last ones left, Rand."
He sounded frightened.
"Whatever it's all about, it's just us two now. Just us."
Rand shook his head. He knew Matt could not see in the darkness, but it was more for himself than Matt, anyway.
"Go to sleep, Matt," he said tiredly.
But he lay awake a long time himself before sleep came.
"Just us."
A cock's crow woke him, and he scrambled out into the false dawn, brushing hay off his clothes. Despite his precautions, some had worked its way down his back. The straws clung between his shoulder blades, itching. He took off his coat and pulled his shirt out of his breeches to get to it. It was while he had one hand down the back of his neck and the other twisted up behind him that he became aware of the people. The sun was not yet truly up, but already a steady trickle moved down the road in ones and twos, trudging toward Camelin. Some with packs or bundles on their backs, others with nothing but a walking staff, if that. Most were young men, but here and there was a girl or someone older. One and all, they had the travel-stained look of having walked a long way. Some had their eyes on their feet and a weary slump to their shoulders, early as it was. Others had their gaze fixed on something out of sight ahead, something toward the dawn. Matt rolled out of the haystack, scratching vigorously. He only paused long enough to wrap the scarf around his head. It shaded his eyes a little less this morning.
"You think we might get something to eat today?"
Rand's stomach rumbled in sympathy.
"We can think about that when we're on the road," he said.
Hastily arranging his clothes, he dug his share of their bundles out of the haystack. By the time they reached the fence, Matt had noticed the people, too. He frowned, stopping in the field while Rand climbed over. A young man, not much older than they, glanced at them as he passed. His clothes were dusty, and so was the blanket roll strapped across his back.
"Where are you bound?" Matt called. "Why, Camelin! For to see the dragon!" the fellow shouted back without stopping.
He raised an eyebrow at the blankets and saddlebags hanging from their shoulders and added,
"Just like you!"
With a laugh, he went on, his eyes already seeking eagerly ahead. Matt asked the same question several times during the day, and the only people who did not much give the same answer were local folk. If those answered at all, it was by spitting and turning away in disgust. They turned away, but they kept a watchful eye, too. They looked at all the travelers the same way, out of the corners of their eyes. Their faces said strangers might get up to anything if not watched. People who lived in the area were not only wary of the strangers, they seemed more than a little put out. Just enough people were on the road, scattered out just enough, that when farmers' carts and wagons appeared with the sun peeking over the horizon, even their usually slow pace was halved. None of them was in any mood to give a ride. A sour grimace and maybe a curse for the work they were missing were more likely. The merchants' wagons rolled by with little hindrance beyond shaken fists, whether they were going toward Camelin or away from it. When the first merchant's train appeared early on in the morning, coming at a stiff trot with the sun barely above the horizon behind the wagons, Rand stepped out of the road. They gave no sign of slowing for anything, and he saw other folks scrambling out of the way. He moved all the way over onto the verge, but kept walking. A flicker of motion as the first wagon rumbled close was all the warning he had. He went sprawling on the ground as the wagon driver's whip cracked in the air where his head had been. From where he lay, he met the driver's eyes as the wagon rolled by. Hard eyes above a mouth in a tight grimace. Not a care that he might have drawn blood or taken an eye.
"Light blind you!" Matt shouted after the wagon. "You can't—"
A mounted guard caught him on the shoulder with the butt of his spear, knocking him down a top rand.
"Out of the way, you dirty dark friend," the guard growled without slowing.
After that, they kept their distance from the wagons. There were certainly enough of them. The rattle and clatter of one hardly faded before another could be heard coming. Guards and drivers, they all stared at the travelers heading for Camlin as if seeing dirt walk. Once Rand misjudged a driver's whip, just by the length of the tip. Clapping his hand to the shallow gash over his eyebrow, he swallowed hard to keep from vomiting at how close it had come to his eye. The driver smirked at him. With his other hand, he grabbed Matt to stop him knocking an arrow.
"Let it go," he said.
He jerked his head at the guards riding alongside the wagons. Some of them were laughing. Others gave Matt's bow a hard eye.
"If we're lucky, they'd just beat us with their spears. If we're lucky."
Matt grunted sourly, but he let Rand pull him on down the road. Twice squadrons of the Queen's guards came trotting down the road, streamers on their lances fluttering in the wind. Some of the farmers hailed them, wanting something done about the strangers, and the guards always paused patiently to listen. Near midday, Rand stopped to listen to one such conversation. Behind the bars of his helmet, the guard captain's mouth was a tight line. "If one of them steals something or trespasses on your land," he growled at the lanky farmer, frowning beside his stirrup, "I'll haul him before a magistrate. But they break no queen's law by walking on the queen's highway."
"But they're all over the place," the farmer protested. "Who knows who they are, or what they are? All this talk about the dragon. Light man, you only have a handful here. Camlin's walls are bulging with them, and more coming every day."
The captain's scowl deepened as he caught sight of Rand and Matt standing in the road nearby. He gestured down the road with a steel-backed gauntlet.
"Get on with you, or I'll have you in for blocking traffic."
His voice was no rougher with them than with the farmer, but they moved on. The captain's eyes followed them for a time. Rand could feel them on his back. He suspected the guards had little patience left with the wanderers and no sympathy for a hungry thief. He decided to stop Matt if he suggested stealing eggs again. Still, there was a good side to all the wagons and people on the road, especially all the young men heading for Camlin. For any dark friends hunting them, it would be like trying to pick out two particular pigeons in a flock. If the murderall on Winter Night had not known exactly who it was after, maybe its fellow would do no better here. His stomach rumbled frequently, reminding him that they had next to no money left, certainly not enough for a meal at the prices charged this close to Camlin. He realized once he had a hand on the flute case, and firmly pushed it around to his back. Goad had known all about the flute and the juggling. There was no telling how much Baalzamon had learned from him before the end, if what Rand had seen had been the end, or how much had been passed to other dark friends. He looked regretfully at a farm they were passing. A man patrolled the fences with a pair of dogs growling and tugging at their leashes. The man looked as if he wanted nothing more than an excuse to let them loose. Not every farm had the dogs out, but no one was offering jobs to travelers. Before the sun went down, he and Matt walked through two more villages. The village folk stood in knots, talking among themselves and watching the steady stream pass by. Their faces were no friendlier than the faces of the farmers, or the wagon drivers, or the queen's guards. All these strangers going to see the false dragon. Fools who did not know enough to stay where they belonged. Maybe followers of the false dragon. Maybe even dark friends, if there was any difference between the two. With evening coming, the stream began to thin at the second town. The few who had money disappeared into the inn, though there seemed to be some argument about letting them inside. Others began hunting for handy hedges or fields with no dogs. By dusk, he and Matt had the Camlin Road to themselves. Matt began talking about finding another haystack, but Rand insisted on keeping on.
"As long as we can see the road," he said. "The further we go before stopping, the further ahead we are."
"If they are chasing you, why should they chase you now, when they've been waiting for you to come to them so far?" It was argument enough for Matt. With frequent glances over his shoulder, he quickened his step. Rand had to hurry to keep up. The night thickened, relieved only a bit by scant moonlight. Matt's burst of energy faded, and his complaints started up again. Aching knots formed in Rand's calves. He told himself he had walked further in a hard day working on the farm with Tam. But repeated as often as he would, he could not make himself believe it. Gritting his teeth, he ignored the aches and pains and would not stop. With Matt complaining and him concentrating on the next step, they were almost in the village before he saw the lights. He tottered to a stop, suddenly aware of a burning that ran from his feet right up his legs. He thought he had a blister on his right foot. At the sight of the village lights, Matt sagged to his knees with a groan.
"Can we stop now?" he panted. "Or do you want to find an inn and hang out a sign for the Dark Friends, or a fade?"
"The other side of the town," Rand answered, staring at the lights. From this distance, in the dark, it could have been Emmons Field.
"What's waiting there?" "Another mile, that's all."
"All? I'm not walking another span!"
Rand's legs felt like fire, but he made himself take a step and then another. It did not get any easier, but he kept on, one step at a time. Before he had gone 10 paces, he heard Matt staggering after him, muttering under his breath. He thought it was just as well he could not make out what Matt was saying. It was late enough for the streets of the village to be empty, though most houses had a light in at least one window. The inn in the middle of town was brightly lit, surrounded by a golden pool that pushed back the darkness. Music and laughter, dimmed by thick walls, drifted from the building. The sign over the door creaked in the wind. At the near end of the inn, a cart and horse stood in the Camlin Road with a man checking the harness. Two men stood at the far end of the building, on the very edge of the light. Rand stopped in the shadows beside a house that stood dark. He was too tired to hunt through the lanes for a way around. A minute resting could not hurt. Just a minute. Just until the men went away. Matt slumped against the wall with a grateful sigh, leaning back as if he meant to go to sleep right there. Something about the two men at the rim of the shadows made Rand uneasy. He could not put a finger on anything, at first, but he realized the man at the cart felt the same way about them. He reached the end of the strap he was checking, adjusted the bit in the horse's mouth, then went back and started over from the beginning again. He kept his head down the whole while, his eyes on what he was doing and away from the other men. It could have been that he simply was not aware of them, though they were less than 50 feet off. Except for the stiff way he moved and the way he sometimes turned awkwardly in what he was doing, so he would not be looking toward them. One of the men in the shadows was only a black shape, but the other stood more into the light with his back to Rand. Even so, it was plain he was not overjoyed at the conversation he was having. He wrung his hands and kept his eyes on the ground, jerking his head in a nod now and then at something the other had said. Rand could not hear anything, but he got the impression that the man in the shadows was doing all the talking. The nervous man just listened and nodded and wrung his hands anxiously. Eventually, the one who was wrapped in darkness turned away, and the nervous fellow started back into the light. Despite the chill, he was mopping his face with a long apron he wore, as if he were drenched in sweat. Skin prickling, Rand watched the shape moving off in the night. He did not know why, but his uneasiness seemed to follow that one, a vague tingling in the back of his neck and the hair stirring on his arms, as if he had suddenly realized something was sneaking up on him. With a quick shake of his head, he rubbed his arms briskly.
"Getting as foolish as Matt, aren't you?"
At that moment, the form slipped by the edge of the light from a window, just on the brink of it, and Rand's skin crawled. The inn sign went scree, scree, scree in the wind, but the dark cloak never stirred.
"Fade,"
he whispered, and Matt jerked to his feet as if he had shouted.
"What?"
He clamped a hand over Matt's mouth.
"Softly."
The dark shape was lost in the darkness.
"Where?" "It's gone now, I think. I hope."
He took his hand away. The only sound Matt made was a long, indrawn breath. The nervous man was almost to the inn door. He stopped and smoothed down his apron, visibly composing himself before he went inside.
"Strange friends you've got, Raymond Holdwin," the man by the cart said suddenly.
It was an old man's voice, but strong. The speaker straightened, shaking his head.
"Strange friends in the dark for an innkeeper."
The nervous man jumped when the other spoke, looking around as if he had not seen the cart and the other man until right then. He drew a deep breath and gathered himself, then asked sharply,
"And what do you mean by that, Almond Bunt?"
"Just what I said, Holdwin. Strange friends. He's not from around here, is he? Lot of odd folk coming through the last few weeks. Awful lot of odd folk."
"You're a fine one to talk."
Holdwin cocked an eye at the man by the cart.
"I know a lot of men, even men from Camlin. Not like you, cooped up alone out on that farm of yours."
He paused, then went on as if he thought he had to explain further.
"He's from Four Kings, looking for a couple of thieves. Young men. They stole a Heronmark sword from him."
Rand's breath had caught at the mention of Four Kings. At the mention of the sword, he glanced at Matt. His friend had his back pressed hard against the wall and was staring into the darkness with eyes so wide they seemed to be all whites. Rand wanted to stare into the night, too. The half-men could be anywhere. But his eyes went back to the two men in front of the inn.
"A Heronmark sword," Bund exclaimed. "No wonder he wants it back."
Holdwyn nodded.
"Yes, and them too. My friend's a rich man, a merchant, and they've been stirring up trouble with the men who work for him, telling wild stories and getting people upset. They're dark friends, and followers of Loghain, too." "Dark friends and followers of the False Dragon, and telling wild stories, too. Getting up to a lot for young fellas. You did say they were young."
There was a sudden note of amusement in Bunt's voice, but the innkeeper did not seem to notice.
"Yes, not yet 20. There's a reward. 100 crowns in gold for the two of them."
Holdwyn hesitated, then added,
"They've sly tongues, these two. The light knows what kind of tales they'll tell, trying to turn people against one another. And dangerous, too, even if they don't look it. Vicious. Best you stay clear if you think you see him. Two young men, one with a sword, and both looking over their shoulders. If they're the right ones, my friend will pick them up once they're located.
You sound almost as if you know them to look at."
"I'll know them when I see them," Holdwyn said confidently. "Just don't try to take them yourself. No need for anyone to get hurt. Come tell me if you see them. My friend will deal with them. 100 crowns for the two, but he wants the pair."
100 crowns for the two, Bunt mused.
"How much for this sword he wants so bad?"
Abruptly, Holdwyn appeared to realize the other man was making fun of him.
"I don't know why I'm telling you," he snapped. "You're still fixed on that fool plan of yours, I see."
"Not such a fool plan," Bunt replied placidly.
"There might not be another false dragon to see before I die. Light send it so. And I'm too old to eat some merchant's dust all the way to Camelin. I'll have the road to myself, and I'll be in Camelin bright and early tomorrow." "To yourself?"
The innkeeper's voice had a nasty quiver.
"You can never tell what might be out in the night, Almond Bunt. All alone on the road, in the dark. Even if somebody hears you scream, there's no one will unbar a door to help. Not these days, Bunt. Not your nearest neighbor."
None of that seemed to ruffle the old farmer at all. He answered as calmly as before.
"If the Queen's guards can't keep the road safe this close to Camelin, then we're none of us safe even in our own beds. If you ask me, one thing the guards could do to make sure the roads are safe would be clap that friend of yours in irons. Sneaking around in the dark, afraid to let anybody get a look at him. Can't tell me he's not up to no good."
"Afraid!" Holdwyn exclaimed. "You old fool! If you knew—"
His teeth clicked shut abruptly, and he gave himself a shake.
"I don't know why I'm wasting time on you. Get off with you! Stop cluttering up the front of my place of business."
The door of the inn boomed shut behind him. Muttering to himself, Bunt took hold of the edge of the cart seat and set his foot on the wheel hub. Rand hesitated only a moment. Matt caught his arm as he started forward.
"Are you crazy, Rand? You'll recognize us for sure."
"You'd rather stay here, with a fate around? How far do you think we'll get on foot before it finds us?"
He tried not to think of how far they would get in a cart if it found them. He shook free of Matt and trotted up the road. He carefully held his cloak shut so the sword was hidden. The wind and the cold were excuse enough for that.
"I couldn't help overhearing you were going to Camelin," he said.
Bunt gave a start, jerking a quarterstaff out of the cart. His leathery face was a mass of wrinkles, and half his teeth were gone, but his gnarled hands held the staff steady. After a minute, he lowered one end of the staff to the ground and leaned on it.
"So you two are going to Camelin. To see the dragon, eh?"
Rand did not realize that Matt had followed him,
Matt was keeping well back, though, out of the light, watching the inn and the old farmer with as much suspicion as he was the knight.
"The false dragon,"
Rand said with emphasis. Bunt nodded.
"Of course, of course."
He threw a sideways look at the inn, then abruptly shoved his staff back under the cart seat.
"Well, if you want a ride, get in. I've wasted enough time."
He was already climbing to the seat. Rand clambered over the back as the farmer flicked the reins. Matt ran to catch up as the cart started off. Rand caught his arms and pulled him aboard. The village faded quickly into the night at the pace Bunt set. Rand lay back on the bare boards, fighting the lulling creak of the wheels. Matt stifled his yawns with a fist, warily staring into the countryside. Darkness weighed heavily on the fields and farms, dotted with the lights of farmhouses. The lights seemed distant, seemed to struggle vainly against the night. An owl called, a mourner's cry, and the wind moaned like lost souls in the shadow.
It could be out there anywhere, Rand thought.
Bunt seemed to feel the oppression of the night, too, for he suddenly spoke up.
"You two ever been to Camelin before?"
He gave a little chuckle.
"Don't suppose you have. Well, wait till you see it. The greatest city in the world. Oh, I've heard all about Ilion and Ibu Dar and Tyr and all. There's always some fool thinks a thing is bigger and better just because it's off somewheres over the horizon. But for my money, Camelin is the grandest there is. Couldn't be grander. Nope, it couldn't. Unless maybe Queen Morgays, the Light Illuminer, got rid of that witch from Tar Valon."
Rand was lying back with his head pillowed on his blanket roll atop the bundle of Tom's cloak, watching the night drift by, letting the farmer's words wash by him. A human voice kept the darkness at bay and muted the mournful wind. He twisted around to look up at the dark mass of Bunt's back.
"You mean an Aes Sedai?"
"What else would I mean? Sitting there in the palace like a spider. I'm a good queen's man, never say I'm not, but it just isn't right. I'm not one of those saying Elida's got too much influence over the queen. Not me. And as for the fools who claim Elida's really the queen in all but name,"
he spat into the night,
"that for them. Morgays is no puppet to dance for any Tar Valon witch."
"Another Aes Sedai. If, when Moraine got to Camelin, she might well go to a sister Aes Sedai. If the worst happened, this Elida might help them reach Tar Valon."
He looked at Matt, and just as if he had spoken aloud, Matt shook his head. He could not see Matt's face, but he knew it was fixed in denial. Bunt went right on talking, flicking the reins whenever his horse slowed, but otherwise letting his hands rest on his knees.
"I'm a good queen's man, like I said, but even fools say something worthwhile now and again. Even a blind pig finds an acorn sometimes. There's got to be some changes. This weather, the crops failing, cows drying up, calves and lambs born dead or with two heads. Bloody ravens don't even wait for things to die. People are scared. They want somebody to blame. Dragon's fang churning up on people's doors, things creeping about in the night, barns getting burned. Fellas around like that friend of Holdwyn, scaring people. The queen's got to do something before it's too late. You see that, don't you?"
Rand made a noncommittal sound. It sounded as if they had been even luckier than he had thought to find this old man in his cart. They might not have gotten further than that last village if they had waited for daylight. Things creeping about in the night. He lifted up to look over the side of the cart at the darkness. Shadows and shapes seemed to writhe in the black. He dropped back before his imagination convinced him there was something there. Bunt took it for agreement.
"Right. I'm a good queen's man, and I'll stand against any who try to harm her. But I'm right. You take the Lady Elaine and the Lord Gawain now. There's a change won't harm anything and might do some good. Sure, I know we've always done it that way in Andor. Send the daughter heir off to Tar Valon to study with the Aes Sedai, and the eldest son off to study with the warders. I believe in tradition, I do. But look what it got us last time. Luke dead in the Blight before he was ever anointed first Prince of the Sword, and Tigraine vanished, run off or dead, when it came time for her to take the throne. Still troubling us, that. There's some saying she's still alive, you know, that Morgays isn't the rightful queen. Bloody fools. I remember what happened. Remember like it was yesterday. No daughter heir to take the throne when the old queen died, and every house in Andor scheming and fighting for the right. And Tarangel Damodred. You wouldn't have thought he'd lost his wife, him hot to figure which house would win so he could marry again and become prince consort after all. Well, he managed it, though Ymor Gaze chose... Ah, no man knows the mind of a woman, and a queen is twice a woman, wed to a man, wed to the land. He got what he wanted anyway, if not the way he wanted it. Brought Cairhien into the plotting before he was done, and you know how that ended. The tree chopped down and black-veiled Aiel coming over the dragon wall. Well, he got himself decently killed after he'd fathered Elaine and Gawain, so there's an end to it, I suppose. But why send them to Tar Valon? It's time men didn't think of the throne of Andor and Aes Sedai in the same thought anymore. If they've got to go someplace else to learn what they need, well, Ilion's got libraries as good as Tar Valon, and they'll teach the Lady Elaine as much about ruling and scheming as ever the witches could. Nobody knows more about scheming than Ilyana. And if the guards can't teach the Lord Gawain enough about soldiering, well, they've soldiers in Ilion, too. And in Shinar, and Tyr, for that matter. I am a good queen's man, but I say let's stop all this truck with Tar Valon. 3,000 years is long enough. Too long. Queen Morgaze can lead us and put things right without help from the White Tower. I tell you, there's a woman makes a man proud to kneel for her blessing. Why, once...
Rand fought the sleep his body cried out for, but the rhythmic creak and the sway of the cart lulled him, and he floated off on the drone of Bunt's voice. He dreamed of Tam. At first they were at the big oak table in the farmhouse, drinking tea while Tam told him about prince consorts and daughter heirs, and the dragon wall and black-veiled Aielman. The heron-marked sword lay on the table between them, but neither of them looked at it. Suddenly he was in the Westwood, pulling the makeshift litter through the moon-bright night. When he looked over his shoulder, it was Tom on the litter, not his father, sitting cross-legged and juggling in the moonlight.
"The queen is wed to the land," Tom said as brightly colored balls danced in a circle. "But the dragon is one with the land, and the land is one with the dragon."
Further back, Rand saw Fade coming, black cloak undisturbed by the wind, horse ghosting silently through the trees. Two severed heads hung at the murdral's saddle bow, dripping blood that ran in darker streams down its mount's coal-black shoulder. Lan and Moraine, faces distorted in grimaces of pain. The Fade pulled on a fistful of tethers as it rode. Each tether ran back to the bound wrists of one of those who ran behind the soundless hooves, their faces blank with despair. Matt and Perrin. And Egwene.
"Not her!" Rand shouted. "The light blast you, it's me you want, not her!"
The half-man gestured and flames consumed Egwene, flesh crisping to ash, bone blacking and crumbling.
"The dragon is one with the land," Tom said, still juggling unconcernedly. "And the land is one with the dragon."
Rand screamed and opened his eyes. The cart creaked along the Camelin Road, filled with night and the sweetness of long-vanished hay and the faint smell of horse. A shape blacker than the night rested on his chest, and eyes blacker than death looked into his.
"You are mine,"
the raven said, and the sharp beak stabbed into his eye. He screamed as it plucked his eyeball out of his head. With a throat-ripping shriek, he sat up, clapping both hands to his face. Early morning daylight bathed the cart. Dazed, he stared at his hands. No blood, no pain. The rest of the dream was already fading, but that... Gingerly, he felt his face and shuddered.
"At least," Matt yawned, cracking his jaws, "at least you got some sleep."
There was little sympathy in his bleary eyes. He was huddled under his cloak, with his blanket roll doubled up beneath his head.
"He talked all bloody night."
"You all the way awake?" Bunt said from the driver's seat. "Gave me a start, you did, yelling like that. Well, we're there."
He swept a hand out in front of them in a grand gesture.
"Camelin, the grandest city in the world."
Chapter 35. Camelin. Rand twisted up to kneel behind the driver's seat. He could not help laughing with relief.
"We made it, Matt. I told you we'd..."
Words died in his mouth as his eyes fell on Camlann. After Baerlon, even more after the ruins of Shadar Logoth, he had thought he knew what a great city would look like. But this was more than he would have believed. Outside the Great Wall, buildings clustered as if every town he had passed through had been gathered and set down there, side by side and all pushed together. Inns thrust their upper stories above the tile roofs of houses, and squat warehouses, broad and windowless, shouldered against them all. Red brick and gray stone and plastered white, jumbled and mixed together, they spread as far as the eye could see. Baerlon could have vanished into it without being noticed, and Whitebridge swallowed up 20 times over with hardly a ripple. And the wall itself, the sheer 50-foot height of pale gray stone, streaked with silver and white, swept out in a great circle, curving to north and south till he wondered how far it must run. All along its length, towers rose, round and standing high above the wall's own height, red and white banners whipping in the wind atop each one. From inside the wall, other towers peeked out, slender towers even taller than those at the walls, and domes gleaming white and gold in the sun. A thousand stories had painted cities in his mind, the great cities of kings and queens, of thrones and powers and legends. And Camlann fit into those mind-deep pictures as water fits into a jug. The cart creaked down the wide road toward the city, toward tower-flanked gates. The wagons of a merchant's train rolled out of those gates, under a vaulting archway in the stone that could have let a giant through, or 10 giants abreast. Unwalled markets lined the road on both sides, roof tiles glistening red and purple, with stalls and pens in the spaces between. Calves bawled, cattle lowed, geese honked, chickens clucked, goats bleated, sheep baaed, and people bargained at the top of their lungs. A wall of noise funneled them toward the gates of Camlann.
"What did I tell you?"
Bunt had to raise his voice to near a shout in order to be heard.
"The grandest city in the world. Built by Ogier, you know. Least the inner city and the palace were. It's that old, Camlann is. Camlann. Where good Queen Morgaze, the Light Illuminer, makes the law and holds the peace for Endor. The greatest city on earth."
Rand was ready to agree. His mouth hung open, and he wanted to put his hands over his ears to shut out the din. People crowded the road as thick as folk in Emmons Field crowded the green at Beltane. He remembered thinking there were too many people in Baerlon to be believed, and almost laughed. He looked at Matt and grinned. Matt did have his hands over his ears, and his shoulders were hunched up as if he wanted to cover them with those, too.
"How are we going to hide in this?" he demanded loudly when he saw Rand looking. "How can we tell who to trust with so many? So bloody many? Light the noise!"
Rand looked at Bunt before answering. The farmer was caught up and staring at the city. With the noise, he might not have heard anyway. Still, Rand put his mouth close to Matt's ear.
"How can they find us among so many? Can't you see it, you wool-headed idiot? We're safe, if you ever learn to watch your bloody tongue."
He flung out a hand to take in everything, the markets, the city walls still ahead.
"Look at it, Matt. Anything could happen here, anything. We might even find Moraine waiting for us, and Egwene and all the rest. If they're alive. If you ask me, they're as dead as the Gleeman."
The grin faded from Rand's face, and he turned to watch the gates come nearer. Anything could happen in a city like Camlann. He held that thought stubbornly. The horse could not move any faster, flap the reins as Bunt would. The closer to the gates they came, the thicker the crowd grew, jostling together, shoulder to shoulder, pressing against the carts and wagons heading in. Rand was glad to see a good many were dusty young men, afoot with little in the way of belongings. Whatever their ages, a lot of the crowd pushing toward the gates had a travel-worn look, rickety carts and tired horses, clothes wrinkled from many nights of sleeping rough, dragging steps and weary eyes. But weary or not, those eyes were fixed on the gates, as if getting inside the walls would strip away all their fatigue. Half a dozen of the Queen's guards stood at the gates, their clean red and white tabards and burnished plate and mail, a sharp contrast to most of the people streaming under the stone arch. Backs rigid and heads straight, they eyed the incomers with disdainful wariness. It was plain they would just as soon have turned away most of those coming in. Aside from keeping a way clear for traffic leaving the city, though, and having a hard word with those who tried to push too fast, they did not hinder anyone.
"Keep your places. Don't push. Don't push. The light blind you,"
There's room for everybody, the light helpless. Keep your places.
Bunt's cart rolled past the gates with the slow tide of the throng into Camelin. The city rose on low hills like steps climbing to a center. Another wall encircled that center, shining pure white and running over the hills. Inside that were even more towers and domes, white and gold and purple, their elevation atop the hills making them seem to look down on the rest of Camelin. Rand thought that must be the inner city of which Bunt had spoken. The Camelin Road itself changed as soon as it was inside the city, becoming a wide boulevard, split down the middle by broad strips of grass and trees. The grass was brown and the tree branches bare, but people hurried by as if they saw nothing unusual, laughing, talking, arguing, doing all the things that people do. Just as if they had no idea that there had been no spring yet this year, and might be none. They did not see, Rand realized. Could not, or would not. Their eyes slid away from leafless branches, and they walked across the dead and dying grass without once looking down. What they did not see, they could ignore. What they did not see was not really there. Gaping at the city and the people, Rand was taken by surprise when the cart turned down a side street, narrower than the boulevard, but still twice as wide as any street in Emmons Field. Bunt drew the horse to a halt and turned to look back at them hesitantly. The traffic was a bit lighter here. The crowd split around the cart without breaking stride.
What you hiding under your cloak? Is it really what Holdwyn says?
Rand was in the act of tossing his saddlebags over his shoulder. He did not even twitch.
What do you mean?
His voice was steady, too. His stomach was a sour knot, but his voice was steady. Rand stifled a yawn with one hand, but he shoved the other under his coat, clutching the dagger from Shadar Logoth, Rand knew, and his eyes had a hard, hunted look under the scarf around his head. Bunt avoided looking at Matt, as if he knew there was a weapon in that hidden hand.
"Don't mean nothing, I suppose. Look now, if you heard I was coming to Camelin, you were there long enough to hear the rest. Was I after a reward? I'd have made some excuse to go in the Goose and Crown, speak to Holdwyn. Only I don't much like Holdwyn, and I don't like that friend of his, not at all. Seems like he wants you two more than he wants anything else."
"I don't know what he wants," Rand said. "We've never seen him before."
It might even be the truth. He could not tell one fade from another.
"Uh-huh. Well, like I say, I don't know nothing. And I guess I don't want to. There's enough trouble around for everybody without I go looking for more."
Matt was slow in gathering his things, and Rand was already in the street before he started climbing down. Rand waited impatiently. Matt turned stiffly from the cart, hugging bow and quiver and blanket roll to his chest, muttering under his breath. Heavy shadows darkened the undersides of his eyes. Rand's stomach rumbled, and he grimaced. Hunger combined with a sour twisting in his gut made him afraid he was going to vomit. Matt was staring at him now, expectantly. Which way to go? What to do now? Bunt leaned over and beckoned him closer. He went, hoping for advice about Camelin.
"I'd hide that."
The old farmer paused and looked around warily. People pushed by on both sides of the cart, but except for a few passing curses about blocking the way, no one paid them any attention.
"Stop wearing it," he said. "Hide it, sell it, give it away. That's my advice. Thing like that's going to draw attention, and I guess you don't want any of that."
Abruptly he straightened, clucking to his horse, and drove slowly on down the crowded street without another word or a backward glance. A wagon loaded with barrels rumbled toward them. Rand jumped out of the way, staggered, and when he looked again, Bunt and his cart were lost to sight.
"What do we do now?" Matt demanded.
He licked his lips, staring wide-eyed at all the people pushing by and the buildings towering as much as 6 stories above the street.
"We're in Camelin, but what do we do?"
He had uncovered his ears, but his hands twitched as if he wanted to put them back. A hum lay on the city, the low, steady drone of hundreds of shops working, thousands of people talking. To Rand, it was like being inside a giant beehive, constantly buzzing.
"Even if they are here, Rand, how can we find them in all of this?"
"Moraine will find us," Rand said slowly. The immensity of the city was a weight on his shoulders. He wanted to get away, to hide from all the people and noise. The void eluded him despite Tam's teachings. His eyes drew the city into it. He concentrated instead on what was right around him, ignoring everything that lay beyond. Just looking at that one street, it almost seemed like Bearlawn. Bearlawn, the last place they had all thought they were safe. Nobody's safe anymore. Maybe they are all dead. What do you do then? They're alive. Egwene's alive, he said fiercely. Several passers-by looked at him oddly.
Maybe, Matt said. Maybe. What if Moraine doesn't find us? What if nobody does, but the...
He shuddered, unable to say it.
We'll think about that when it happens, he told Matt firmly. If it happens.
The worst meant seeking out Elida, the Aes Sedai in the palace. He would go on to Tar Valon first. He did not know if Matt remembered what Tom had said about the Red Aja and the Black, but he surely did. His stomach twisted again. Tom said to find an inn called the Queen's Blessing. We'll go there first.
How? We can't afford one meal between the two of us.
At least it's a place to start. Tom thought we could find help there.
I can't... Rand, they're everywhere!
Matt dropped his eyes to the paving stones and seemed to shrink in on himself, trying to pull away from the people that were all around them.
Wherever we go, they're right behind us, or they're waiting for us. They'll be at the Queen's Blessing, too. Nothing's going to stop a fade!
Rand grabbed Matt's collar in a fist that he was trying hard to keep from trembling. He needed Matt. Maybe the others were alive, like please, but right then and there it was just Matt and him. The thought of going on alone... He swallowed hard, tasting bile. He looked around quickly. No one seemed to have heard Matt mention the fade. The crowd pressed past, lost in its own worries. He put his face close to Matt's.
We've made it this far, haven't we?
He asked in a hoarse whisper.
They haven't caught us yet. We can make it all the way if we just don't quit. I won't just quit and wait for them like a sheep for slaughter. I won't. Well, are you going to stand here till you starve to death, or until they come pick you up in a sack?
He let go of Matt and turned away. His fingernails dug into his palms, but his hands still trembled. Suddenly Matt was walking alongside him, his eyes still down, and Rand let out a long breath.
I'm sorry, Rand, Matt mumbled.
Forget it, Rand said.
Matt barely looked up enough to keep from walking into people while the words poured out in a lifeless voice.
I can't stop thinking I'll never see home again. I want to go home. Laugh if you want, I don't care. What I wouldn't give to have my mother blessing me out for something right now. It's like weights on my brain. Hot weights. Strangers all around. And no way to tell who to trust, if I can trust anybody. Light, the Two Rivers is so far away, it might as well be on the other side of the world. We're alone and we'll never get home. We're going to die, Rand.
Not yet, we won't, Rand retorted. Everybody dies. The wheel turns. I'm not going to curl up and wait for it to happen, though.
You sound like Master Alvear, Matt grumbled, but his voice had a little spirit in it.
Good, Rand said. Good.
Light, let the others be all right. Please don't let us be alone.
He began asking directions to the Queen's Blessing. The responses varied widely, a curse for all those who did not stay where they belonged, or a shrug and a blank look being the most common. Some stalked on by with no more than a glance, if that. A broad-faced man, nearly as big as Perrin, cocked his head and said,
"A Queen's Blessing, eh? You country boys, Queen's men?"
He wore a white cockade on his wide-brimmed hat and a white armband on his long coat.
"Well, you've come too late."
He went off roaring with laughter, leaving Rand and Matt to stare at one another in puzzlement. Rand shrugged. There were plenty of odd folk in Camelon, people like he had never seen before. Some of them stood out in the crowd, skins too dark or too pale, coats of strange cut or bright colors, hats with pointed peaks or long feathers. There were women with veils across their faces, women in stiff dresses as wide as the wearer was tall, women in dresses that left more skin bare than any tavern maid he had seen. Occasionally a carriage, all vivid paint and gilt, squeezed through the thronged streets behind a 4 or 6 horse team with plumes on their harness. Sedan chairs were everywhere, the Pullman pushing along with never a care for who they shoved aside.
Rand saw one fight start that way, a brawling heap of men swinging their fists, while a pale-skinned man, in a red-striped coat, climbed out of the sedan chair lying on its side. Two roughly dressed men, who seemed to have been just passing by up till then, jumped on him before he was clear. The crowd that had stopped to watch began to turn ugly, muttering and shaking fists. Rand pulled at Matt's sleeve and hurried on. Matt needed no second urging. The roar of a small riot followed them down the street. Several times men approached the two of them instead of the other way around. Their dusty clothes marked them as newcomers and seemed to act like a magnet on some types. Furtive fellows who offered relics of Loghain for sale with darting eyes and feet set to run. Rand calculated he was offered enough scraps of the false dragon's cloak and fragments of his sword to make two swords and half a dozen cloaks. Matt's face brightened with interest, the first time at least, but Rand gave them all a curt no, and they took it with a bob of the head and a quick, "Light illumine the queen, good master," and vanished. Most of the shops had plates and cups painted with fanciful scenes, purporting to show the false dragon being displayed before the queen in chains. And there were white cloaks in the streets. Each walked in an open space that moved with him, just as in Barillon. Staying unnoticed was something Rand thought about a great deal. He kept his cloak over his sword, but that would not be good enough for very long. Sooner or later, someone would wonder what he was hiding. He would not, could not, take Bunt's advice to stop wearing it. Not his link to Tam, to his father. Many others among the throng wore swords, but none with the heron mark to pull the eye. All the Camelin men, though, and some of the strangers had their swords wound in strips of cloth, sheath and hilt, red-bound with white cord, or white-bound with red. 100 heron marks could be hidden under those wrappings, and no one would see. Besides, following local fashion would make them seem to fit in more. A good many shops were fronted with tables displaying the cloth and cord, and Rand stopped at one. The red cloth was cheaper than the white, though he could see no difference apart from the color. So he bought that and the white cord to go with it, despite Matt's complaints about how little money they had left. The tight-lipped shopkeeper eyed them up and down with a twist to his mouth while he took Rand's coppers, and cursed them when Rand asked for a place inside to wrap his sword. "We didn't come to see Loghain," Rand said patiently. "We just came to see Camelin." He remembered Bunt and added, "The grandest city in the world." The shopkeeper's grimace remained in place. "The light illumine, good Queen Morghese," Rand said hopefully. "You make any trouble," the man said sourly, "and there's 100 men in sound of my voice will take care of you, even if the guards won't." He paused to spit, just missing Rand's foot. "Get on about your filthy business." Rand nodded as if the man had bid him a cheerful farewell, and pulled Matt away. Matt kept looking back over his shoulder toward the shop, growling to himself, until Rand tugged him into an empty alleyway. With their backs to the street, no passerby could see what they were doing. Rand pulled off the sword belt and set to wrapping the sheath and hilt. "I'll bet he charged you double for that bloody cloth," Matt said. "Triple." It was not as easy as it looked, fastening the strips of cloth and the cord so the whole thing would not fall off. "They'll all be trying to cheat us, Rand. They think we've come to see the false dragon like everybody else. We'll be lucky if somebody doesn't hit us on the head while we sleep. This is no place to be. There are too many people. Let's leave for Tarvalin now. Or south to Ilion. I wouldn't mind seeing them gather for the Hunt of the Horn. If we can't go home, let's just go." "I'm staying," Rand said. "If they're not here already, they'll come here sooner or later looking for us." He was not sure if he had the wrappings done the way everyone else did, but the herons and the scabbard and hilt were hidden, and he thought it was secure. As he went back out on the street, he was sure that he had one less thing to worry about causing trouble. Matt trailed along beside him, as reluctantly as if he were being pulled on a leash. Bit by bit, Rand did get the directions he wanted. At first they were vague, on the order of "somewhere in that direction," and "over that way." The nearer they came, though, the clearer the instructions, until at last they stood before a broad stone building with a sign over the door creaking in the wind. A man kneeling before a woman, with red-gold hair and a crown, one of her hands resting on his bowed head. The Queen's blessing. "Are you sure about this?" Matt asked. "Of course," Rand said. He took a deep breath and pushed open the door. The common room was large and paneled with dark wood, and fires on two hearths warmed it. A serving maid was sweeping the floor, though it was clean, and another was polishing candlesticks in the corner. Each smiled at the two newcomers before going back to her work. Only a few tables had people at them, but a dozen men was a crowd for so early in the day, and if none looked exactly happy to see him and Matt, at least they looked clean and sober. The smells of roasting beef and baking bread drifted from the kitchen, making Rand's mouth water. The innkeeper was fat, he was pleased to see, a pink-faced man in a starched white apron, with graying hair combed back over a bald spot that did not quite cover. His sharp eye took them in from head to toe, dusty clothes and bundles and worn boots, but he had a ready, pleasant smile, too. Basil Gill was his name.
"Master Gill," Rand said, "a friend of ours told us to come here. Tom Marilyn.
The innkeeper's smile slipped. Rand looked at Matt, but he was too busy sniffing the aromas coming from the kitchen to notice anything else.
"Is there something wrong? You do know him."
"I know him," Gill said curtly.
He seemed more interested in the flute case at Rand's side now than in anything else.
"Come with me."
He jerked his head toward the back. Rand gave Matt a jerk to get him started, then followed, wondering what was going on. In the kitchen, Master Gill paused to speak to the cook, a round woman with her hair in a bun at the back of her head, who almost matched the innkeeper pound for pound. She kept stirring her pots while Master Gill talked. The smells were so good, 2 days' hunger made a fine sauce for anything, but this smelled as good as Mistress Alvear's kitchen, that Rand's stomach growled. Matt was leaning toward the pots, nose first. Rand nudged him. Matt hastily wiped his chin where he had been drooling. Then the innkeeper was hurrying them out the back door. In the stable yard, he looked around to make sure no one was close, then rounded on them. On Rand.
"What's in the case, lad?"
"Tom's flute," Rand said slowly.
He opened the case as if showing the gold and silver chased flute would help. Matt's hand crept under his coat. Master Gill did not take his eyes off Rand.
I recognize it. I saw him play it often enough, and there's not likely two like that outside a royal court."
The pleasant smiles were gone, and his sharp eyes were suddenly as sharp as a knife.
"How did you come by it? Tom would part with his arm as soon as that flute."
"He gave it to me."
Rand took Tom's bundled cloak from his back and set it on the ground, unfolding enough to show the colored patches, as well as the end of the harp case.
"Tom's dead, Master Gill. If he was your friend, I'm sorry. He was mine, too."
"Dead, you say? How?"
A man tried to kill us. Tom pushed this at me and told us to run."
The patches fluttered in the wind like butterflies. Rand's throat caught. He folded the cloak carefully back up again.
"We'd have been killed if it hadn't been for him. We were on our way to Camelin together. He told us to come here, to your inn."
"I'll believe he's dead," the innkeeper said slowly, "when I see his corpse."
He nudged the bundled cloak with his toe and cleared his throat roughly.
Nay, I believe you. You saw whatever it was you saw. I just don't believe he's dead. He's a harder man to kill than you might believe, is old Tom Marilyn."
Rand put a hand on Matt's shoulder.
"It's all right, Matt. He's a friend."
Master Gill glanced at Matt and sighed.
"I suppose I am at that."
Matt straightened up slowly, folding his arms over his chest. He was still watching the innkeeper warily, though, and a muscle in his cheek twitched.
"Coming to Camelin, you say?"
The innkeeper shook his head.
"This is the last place on earth I'd expect Tom to come, excepting maybe it was Tarvalin."
He waited for a stableman to pass, leading a horse, and even then he lowered his voice.
"You've trouble with the eyes and eye, I take it."
"Yes,"
Matt grumbled at the same time that Rand said.
"What makes you think that?"
Master Gill chuckled dryly.
"I know the man, that's what. He'd jump into that kind of trouble, especially to help a couple of lads about the age of you."
The reminiscence in his eyes flickered out, and he stood up straight with a chary look.
Now, I'm not making any accusations, mine, but I take it neither of you can, what I'm getting at is, What exactly is the nature of your trouble with Tarvalin, if you don't mind my asking?
Rand's skin prickled as he realized what the man was suggesting. The One Power.
No, no, nothing like that. I swear.
There was even an Aes Sedai helping us.
Moraine was...
He bit his tongue, but the innkeeper's expression never changed.
Glad to hear it. Not that I have all that much love for Aes Sedai, but better them than... that other thing.
He shook his head slowly.
Too much talk of that kind of thing, with Loghain being brought here. No offense meant, you understand, but... well, I had to know, didn't I?
No offense, Rand said. Matt's murmur could have been anything, but the innkeeper appeared to take it for the same as Rand had said.
You two look the right sort, and I do believe you were... are friends of Tom. But it's hard times and stony days. I don't suppose you can pay. No, I didn't think so. There's not enough of anything, and what there is costs the earth. So I'll give you beds, not the best, but warm and dry, and something to eat. And I cannot promise more, however much I'd like.
Thank you, Rand said, with a quizzical glance at Matt. It's more than I expected. What was the right sort, and why should he promise more?
Well, Tom's a good friend. An old friend. Hot-headed and liable to say the worst possible thing to the one person he shouldn't. But a good friend, all the same. If he doesn't show up, well, we'll figure something out then. Best you don't talk any more talk about Aes Sedai helping you. I'm a good Queen's man, but there are too many in Camelon right now who'd take it wrong. And I don't mean just the White Cloaks.
Matt snorted.
For all I care, the Ravens can take every Aes Sedai straight to Shael Ghul. Watch your tongue,
Master Gil snapped.
I said I don't love them. I didn't say I'm a fool thinks they're behind everything that's wrong. The Queen supports Elida and the guards stand for the Queen. The lights and things don't go so bad, that changes. Anyway, lately some guards have forgotten themselves enough to be a little rough with folks they overhear speaking against Aes Sedai. Not on duty, thank the light, but it's happened just the same. I don't need off-duty guards breaking up my common room to teach you a lesson. And I don't need White Cloaks egging somebody on to paint the dragon's fang on my door. So if you want any help out of me, you just keep thoughts about Aes Sedai to yourself, good or bad.
He paused thoughtfully, then added,
maybe it's best you don't mention Tom's name either, or anyone but me can hear. Some of the guards have long memories, and so does the Queen. No need taking chances.
Tom had trouble with the Queen? Rand said incredulously, and the innkeeper laughed.
So he didn't tell you everything. Don't know why he should. On the other hand, I don't know why you shouldn't know either. Not like it's a secret, exactly. Do you think every gleeman thinks as much of himself as Tom does? Well, come to think of it, I guess they do. But it always seemed to me Tom had an extra helping of thinking a lot of himself. He wasn't always a gleeman, you know, wandering from village to village and sleeping under a hedge as often as not. There was a time Tom Merlin was court bard right here in Camelon, and known in every royal court from Tyr to Maradon.
Tom?
Matt said. Rand nodded slowly. He could picture Tom at a queen's court with his stately manner and grand gestures.
That he was, Master Gil said. It was not long after Tarengil Damodred died that the trouble about his nephew cropped up. There were some said Tom was, shall we say, closer to the queen than was proper. But Morgaze was a young widow, and Tom was in his prime then, and the queen can do as she wishes, is the way I look at it. Only she's always had a temper, has our good Morgaze, and he took off without a word when he learned what kind of trouble his nephew was in. The queen didn't much like that. Didn't like him meddling in Aes Sedai matters, either. Can't say I think it was right, either, nephew or no. Anyway, when he came back, he said some words, all right. Words you don't say to a queen. Words you don't say to any woman with Morgaze's spirit. Elida was set against him because of his trying to mix in the business with his nephew. And between the queen's temper and Elida's animosity,
Tom left Camlin half a step ahead of a trip to prison, if not the headsman's axe. As far as I know, the writ still stands.
If it was a long time ago, Rand said, maybe nobody remembers.
Master Gill shook his head.
Gareth Bryn is Captain General of the Queen's Guards. He personally commanded the guardsman Morgay sent to bring Tom back in chains, and I misdoubt he'll ever forget returning empty-handed to find Tom had already been back to the palace and left again. And the Queen never forgets anything. You ever know a woman who did? My, but Morgay's was in a taking. I'll swear the whole city walked soft and whispered for a month. Plenty of other guardsmen old enough to remember, too. No, best you keep Tom as close a secret as you keep that Aes Sedai of yours. Come, I'll get you something to eat. You look as if your bellies are gnawing at your backbones.
Chapter 36 Web of the Pattern.
Master Gill took them to a corner table in the common room and had one of the serving maids bring them food. Rand shook his head when he saw the plates, with a few thin slices of gravy-covered beef, a spoonful of mustard greens, and two potatoes on each. It was a rueful, resigned headshake, though, not angry. Not enough of anything, the innkeeper had said. Picking up his knife and fork, Rand wondered what would happen when there was nothing left. It made his half-covered plate seem like a feast. It made him shiver. Master Gill had chosen a table well away from anyone else, and he sat with his back to the corner where he could watch the room. Nobody could get close enough to overhear what they said without him seeing. When the maid left, he said softly,
"No, why don't you tell me about this trouble of yours? If I'm going to help, I'd best know what I'm getting into."
Rand looked at Matt, but Matt was frowning at his plate as if he were mad at the potato he was cutting. Rand took a deep breath.
"I don't really understand it myself," he began.
He kept the story simple, and he kept trollocs and fades out of it. When somebody offered help, it would not do to tell them it was all about fables. But he did not think it was fair to understate the danger either, not fair to pull someone in when they had no idea what they were getting into. Some men were after him and Matt, and a couple of friends of theirs, too. They appeared where they were least expected, these men, and they were deadly dangerous and set on killing him and his friends, or worse. Moraine said some of them were dark friends. Tom did not trust Moraine completely, but he stayed on with them, he said, because of his nephew. They had been separated during an attack while trying to reach Whitebridge, and then, in Whitebridge, Tom died, saving them from another attack. And there had been other tries. He knew there were holes in it, but it was the best he could do on short notice without telling more than was safe.
"We just kept on till we reached Camlin," he explained. "That was the plan, originally. Camlin and then Tarvalin."
He shifted uncomfortably on the edge of his chair. After keeping everything secret for so long, it felt odd to be telling somebody even as much as he was.
"If we stay on that route, the others will be able to find us, sooner or later."
"If they're alive,"
Matt muttered at his plate. Rand did not even glance at Matt. Something compelled him to add,
"It could bring you trouble, helping us."
Master Gill waved it off with a plump hand.
"Can't say as I want trouble, but it wouldn't be the first I've seen. No bloody dark friend will make me turn my back on Tom's friends. This friend of yours from up north now, if she comes to Camlin, I'll hear. There are people keep their eyes on comings and goings like that around here, and word spreads."
Rand hesitated, then asked,
"What about Elida?"
The innkeeper hesitated, too, and finally shook his head.
"I don't think so. Maybe if you didn't have a connection to Tom, she'd winkle it out, and then where would you be? No telling. Maybe in a cell. Maybe worse. They say she has a way of feeling things. What's happened, what's going to happen. They say she can cut right through to what a man wants to hide. I don't know, but I wouldn't risk it. If it wasn't for Tom, you could go to the guards. They'd take care of any dark friends quick enough. But even if you could keep Tom quiet from the guards, word would reach Elida as soon as you mentioned dark friends, and then you're back where we started."
"No guards," Rand agreed.
Matt nodded vigorously while stuffing a fork into his mouth and got gravy on his chin.
"Trouble is, you're caught up in the fringes of politics, lad.
even if it's none of your doing. And politics is a foggy mire full of snakes.
What about...
Rand began, but the innkeeper grimaced suddenly, his chair creaking under his bulk as he sat up straight. The cook was standing in the doorway to the kitchen, wiping her hands with her apron. When she saw the innkeeper looking, she motioned for him to come, then vanished back into the kitchen.
Might as well be married to her,
Master Gill sighed. Finds things that need fixing before I know there's anything wrong. If it's not the drain stopped up or the downspouts clogged, it's rats. I keep a clean place, you understand, but with so many people in the city, rats are everywhere. Crowd people together and you get rats. And Camlin is a plague of them all of a sudden. You wouldn't believe what a good cat, a prime ratter, fetches these days. Your room is in the attic. I'll tell the girls which. Any of them can show you to it. And don't worry about dark friends. I can't say much good about the white cloaks, but between them and the guards, that sort won't dare show their filthy faces in Camlin.
His chair squeaked again as he pushed it back and stood.
I hope it isn't the drains again.
Rand went back to his food, but he saw that Matt had stopped eating.
I thought you were hungry, he said.
Matt kept staring at his plate, pushing one piece of potato in a circle with his fork.
You have to eat, Matt. We need to keep up our strength if we're going to reach Tarvalin.
Matt let out a low, bitter laugh.
Tarvalin! All this time it's been Camlin. Moraine will be waiting for us in Camlin. We'd find Perrin and Egwene in Camlin. Everything would be all right if we only got to Camlin. Well, here we are, and nothing's right. No Moraine, no Perrin, no anybody. Now it's everything will be all right if we only get to Tarvalin.
We're alive, Rand said, more sharply than he had intended. He took a deep breath and tried to moderate his tone.
We're alive. That much is all right. And I intend to stay alive. I intend to find out why we're so important. I won't give up.
All these people, and any of them, could be dark friends. Master Gill promised to help us awfully quick. What kind of man just shrugs off Aes Sedai and dark friends? It isn't natural. Any decent person would tell us to get out, or something.
Eat, Rand said gently, and watched until Matt began chewing a piece of beef. He left his own hands resting beside his plate for a minute, pressing them against the table to keep them from shaking. He was scared. Not about Master Gill, of course, but there was enough without that. Those tall city walls would not stop a fade. Maybe he should tell the innkeeper about that. But even if Gill believed, would he be as willing to help if he thought a fade might show up at the Queen's Blessing? And the rats... Maybe rats did thrive where there were a lot of people, but he remembered the dream that was not a dream in Berlon, and a small spine snapping.
Sometimes the Dark One uses carrion eaters as eyes, Lan had said. Ravens, crows, rats.
He ate, but when he was done, he could not remember tasting a single bite. A serving maid, the one who had been polishing candlesticks when they came in, showed them up to the attic room. A dormer window pierced the slanting outer wall, with a bed on either side of it, and pegs beside the door for hanging their belongings. The dark-eyed girl had a tendency to twist her skirt and giggle whenever she looked at Rand. She was pretty, but he knew if he said anything to her, he would just make a fool of himself. She made him wish he had Perrin's way with girls. He was glad when she left. He expected some comment from Matt, but as soon as she was gone, Matt threw himself on one of the beds, still in his cloak and boots, and turned his face to the wall. Rand hung his things up, watching Matt's back. He thought Matt had his hand under his coat, clutching that dagger again.
"You're just going to lie up here, hiding?" he said finally.
"I'm tired," Matt mumbled.
"We have questions to ask Master Gill yet. He might even be able to tell us how to find Egwene and Perrin. They could be in Camlin already if they managed to hang on to their horses."
"They're dead,"
Matt said to the wall. Rand hesitated, then gave up. He closed the door softly behind him, hoping Matt really would sleep. Downstairs, however, Master Gill was nowhere to be found, though the sharp look in the cook's eye said she was looking for him too. For a while, Rand sat in the common room, but he found himself eyeing every patron who came in, every stranger who could be anyone or anything, especially in the moment when he was first silhouetted as a cloaked black shape in the doorway. A fade in the room would be like a fox in a chicken coop. A guardsman entered from the street.
The red-uniformed man stopped just inside the door, running a cool eye over those in the room who were obviously from outside the city. Rand studied the tabletop when the guardsman's eyes fell on him. When he looked up again, the man was gone. The dark-eyed maid was passing with her arms full of towels.
"They do that sometimes," she said in a confiding tone as she went by. "Just to see there's no trouble. They look after good queensfolk, they do. Nothing for you to worry about."
She giggled. Rand shook his head. Nothing for him to worry about. It was not as if the guardsman would have come over and demanded to know if he knew Tom Marilyn. He was getting as bad as Matt. He scraped back his chair. Another maid was checking the oil in the lamps along the wall. "Is there another room where I could sit?" he asked her. He did not want to go back upstairs and shut himself up with Matt's sullen withdrawal. "Maybe a private dining room that's not being used?"
"There's the library," she pointed to a door. "Through there, to your right, at the end of the hall. Might be empty this hour."
"Thank you. If you see Master Gill, would you tell him Randolph Thor needs to talk to him, if he can spare a minute?"
"I'll tell him,"
she said, then grinned.
"Cook wants to talk to him, too."
The innkeeper was probably hiding, he thought, as he turned away from her. When he stepped into the room to which she had directed him, he stopped and stared. The shelves must have held 300 or 400 books, more than he had ever seen in one place before. Cloth-bound, leather-bound with gilded spines, only a few with wooden covers. His eyes gobbled up the titles, picking out old favorites. The Travels of Jay and Farstrider, The Essays of Willem Manaches. His breath caught at the sight of a leather-bound copy of Voyages Among the Sea Folk. Tam had always wanted to read that. Picturing Tam, turning the book over in his hands with a smile, getting the feel of it before settling down before the fireplace with his pipe to read, his own hand tightened on his sword hilt with a sense of loss and emptiness that dampened all his pleasure in the books. A throat cleared behind him, and he suddenly realized he was not alone. Ready to apologize for his rudeness, he turned. He was used to being taller than almost everyone he met, but this time his eyes traveled up and up and up, and his mouth fell open. Then he came to the head, almost reaching the 10-foot ceiling. A nose as broad as the face, so wide it was more a snout than a nose. Eyebrows that hung down like tails, framing pale eyes as big as teacups. Ears that poked up to tufted points through a shaggy black mane.
"Trolloc!"
He let out a yell and tried to back up and draw his sword. His feet got tangled and he sat down hard instead.
"I wish you humans wouldn't do that," rumbled a voice as deep as a drum.
The tufted ears twitched violently, and the voice became sad.
"So few of you remember us. It's our own fault, I suppose. Not many of us have gone out among men since the shadow fell on the ways. That's, oh, 6 generations now. Right after the War of the 100 Years, it was."
The shaggy head shook and let out a sigh that would have done credit to a bull.
"Too long, too long. And so few to travel and see, it might as well have been done."
Rand sat there for a minute, with his mouth hanging open, staring up at the apparition in wide-toed, knee-high boots and a dark blue coat that buttoned from the neck to the waist, then flared out to his boot tops like a kilt over baggy trousers. In one hand was a book, seeming tiny by comparison, with a finger broad enough for 3 marking the place.
"I thought you were,"
he began, then caught himself.
"What are—"
That was not any better. Getting to his feet, he gingerly offered his hand.
"My name is Randall Thor."
A hand as big as a ham engulfed his. It was accompanied by a formal bow.
"Loyal, son of Arendt, son of Holland. Your name sings in my ears, Randall Thor."
That sounded like a ritual greeting to Rand. He returned the bow.
"Your name sings in my ears, Loyal, son of Arendt, son of Holland."
It was all a little unreal. He still did not know what Loyal was. The grip of Loyal's huge fingers was surprisingly gentle, but he was still relieved to get his hand back in one piece.
"You humans are very excitable," Loyal said in his bass rumble. I had heard all the stories and read the books, of course, but I didn't realize. My first day in Camelin, I could not believe the uproar. Children cried and women screamed, and a mob chased me all the way across the city, waving clubs and knives and torches and shouting, "Trolloc!" I'm afraid I was almost beginning to get a little upset. There's no telling what would have happened if a party of the Queen's guards hadn't come along.
A lucky thing, Rand said faintly.
Yes, but even the guardsmen seemed almost as afraid of me as the others. 4 days in Camelin now, and I haven't been able to put my nose outside this inn. Good Master Gill even asked me not to use the common room.
His ears twitched.
Not that he hasn't been very hospitable, you understand. But there was a bit of trouble that first night. All the humans seemed to want to leave at once. Such screaming and shouting, everyone trying to get through the door at the same time. Some of them could have been hurt.
Rand stared in fascination at those twitching ears.
I'll tell you it was not for this I left the steading.
You're an Ogier, Rand exclaimed. Wait. 6 generations? You said the War of the 100 Years. How old are you?
He knew it was rude as soon as he said it, but Loyal became defensive rather than offended.
90 years, the Ogier said stiffly. In only 10 more, I'll be able to address the stump. I think the Elder should have let me speak, since they were deciding whether I could leave or not. But then they always worry about anyone of any age going outside. You humans are so hasty, so erratic.
He blinked and gave a short bow.
Please forgive me, I shouldn't have said that. But you do fight all the time, even when there's no need to.
That's all right, Rand said. He was still trying to take in Loyal's age. Older than old Sen Bui, and still not old enough to... He sat down in one of the high-backed chairs. Loyal took another... Made to hold 2. He filled it. Sitting, he was as tall as most men standing. At least they did let you go. Loyal looked at the floor, wrinkling his nose and rubbing at it with 1 thick finger.
Well, as to that now. You see, the stump had not been meeting very long, not even a year. But I could tell from what I heard that by the time they reached a decision, I would be old enough to go without their permission. I'm afraid they'll say I put a long handle on my axe, but I just left. The elders always said I was too hot-headed, and I fear I've proven them right. I wonder if they have realized I'm gone yet. But I had to go.
Rand bit his lip to keep from laughing. If Loyal was a hot-headed Ogier, he could imagine what most Ogier were like. Had not been meeting very long, not even a year, Master Alvir would just shake his head in wonder. A village council meeting that lasted 30 days would have everybody jumping up and down, even Harald Luhan. A wave of homesickness swept over him, making it hard to breathe from memories of Tam and Egwene, and the Wine Spring Inn and Beltine on the Green in happier days. He forced them away.
If you don't mind my asking, he said, clearing his throat, why did you want to go, outside so much? I wished I'd never left my home myself.
Why, to see,
Loyal said, as if it were the most obvious thing in the world.
I read the books, all the travelers' accounts, and it began to burn in me that I had to see, not just read.
His pale eyes brightened and his ears stiffened.
I studied every scrap I could find about traveling, about the ways and customs in human lands, and the cities we built for you humans after the breaking of the world. And the more I read, the more I knew that I had to go outside, go to those places we had been, and see the groves for myself.
Rand blinked. Groves?
Yes, the groves. The trees. Only a few of the great trees, of course, towering to the sky to keep memories of the steading fresh.
His chair groaned as he shifted forward, gesturing with his hands, one of which still held the book. His eyes were brighter than ever, and his ears almost quivered.
"Mostly they use the trees of the land and the place. You cannot make the land go against itself. Not for long. The land will rebel. You must shape the vision to the land, not the land to the vision. In every grove was planted every tree that would grow and thrive in that place, each balanced against the next, each place to complement the others, for the best growing, of course, but also so that the balance would sing in the eye and the heart. Ah, the books spoke of groves to make elders weep and laugh at the same time. Groves to remain green in memory forever.
What about the cities? Rand asked.
Loyal gave him a puzzled look.
The cities? The cities the Ogier built. Here, for instance, Camelin. Ogier built Camelin, didn't you? The stories say so.
Working with stone.
His shoulders gave a massive shrug.
That was just something we learned in the years after the breaking. During the exile, when we were still trying to find the steading again. It is a fine thing, I suppose, but not the true thing. Try as you will, and I have read that the Ogier, who built those cities, truly did try. You cannot make stone live. A few still do work with stone, but only because you humans damage the building so often with your wars. There were a handful of Ogier in... Kyrian, it's called now, when I passed through. They were from another steading, luckily, so they didn't know about me. But they were still suspicious that I was outside alone so young. I suppose it's just as well there was no reason for me to linger there. In any case, you see, working with stone is just something that was thrust on us by the weaving of the pattern. The groves came from the heart.
Rand shook his head. Half the stories he had grown up with had just been stood on their heads.
I didn't know Ogier believed in the pattern, Loyal.
Of course we believe. The Wheel of Time weaves the pattern of the ages, and lives are the threads it weaves. No one can tell how the thread of his own life will be woven into the pattern, or how the thread of a people will be woven. It gave us the breaking of the world, and the exile, and stone, and the longing, and eventually it gave us back the steading before we all died. Sometimes I think the reason you humans are the way you are is because your threads are so short. They must jump around in the weaving. Oh, there I've done it again. The elders say you humans don't like to be reminded of how short a life you live. I hope I didn't hurt your feelings.
Rand laughed and shook his head.
Not at all. I suppose it'd be fun to live as long as you do, but I never really thought about it. I guess if I live as long as old Sen Bui, that'll be long enough for anybody.
He is a very old man?
Rand just nodded. He was not about to explain that old Sen Bui was not quite as old as Loyal.
Well, Loyal said, perhaps you humans do have short lives, but you do so much with them, always jumping around, always so hasty. And you have the whole world to do it in. We Ogier are bound to our steading.
You're outside.
For a time, Rand, but I must go back eventually. This world is yours, yours and your kind's. The steading are mine. There's too much hurly-burly outside, and so much has changed from what I read about.
Well, things do change over the years. Some, anyway.
Some? Half the cities I read about aren't even there any longer, and most of the rest are known by different names. You take Kyrian. The city's proper name is Alkai Ryan Alan, Hill of the Golden Dawn. They don't even remember for all of the sunrise on their banners. And the grove there, I doubt if it has been tended since the Trolloc Wars. It's just another forest now, where they cut firewood. The great trees are all gone, and no one remembers them. And here, Camelin is still Camelin, but they let the city grow right over the grove. We're not a quarter of a mile from the center of it, right where we sit, from where the center of it should be. Not a tree of it left. I've been to Tyr and Ilion, too. Different names and no memories. There's only pasture for their horses where the grove was at Tyr, and at Ilion the grove is in the king's park, where he hunts his deer, and none allowed inside without his permission. It is all changed, Rand. I fear very much that I will find the same everywhere I go. All the groves gone, all the memories gone, all the dreams dead.
You can't give up, Loyal. You can't ever give up. If you give up, you might as well be dead. Rand sank back in his chair, as far as he could go, his face turning red. He expected the Ogier to laugh at him, but Loyal nodded gravely instead.
Yes, that's the way of your kind, isn't it?
The Ogier's voice changed, as if he were quoting something.
Till shade is gone, till water is gone, into the shadow with teeth bared, screaming defiance with the last breath to spit in sight-blinder's eye on the last day.
Loyal cocked his shaggy head expectantly, but Rand had no idea what it was he expected. A minute went by with Loyal waiting, then another, and his long eyebrows began to draw down in puzzlement. But he still waited, the silence growing uncomfortable for Rand. "The great trees," Rand said finally, just for something to break that silence. "Are they like Avendasora?" Loyal sat up sharply. His chair squealed and cracked so loudly Rand thought it was going to come apart.
"You know better than that. You, of all people."
"Me? How would I know?"
"Are you playing a joke on me? Sometimes you Aielmen think the oddest things are funny."
"What? I'm not an Aielman. I'm from the Two Rivers. I never even saw an Aielman." Loyal shook his head, and the tufts on his ears drooped outward.
"You see, everything is changed, and half of what I know is useless. I hope I did not offend you. I'm sure your Two Rivers is a very fine place, wherever it is."
"Somebody told me," Rand said, "that it was once called Manetheren. I'd never heard of it, but maybe you." The Ogier's ears had perked up happily.
"Ah, yes, Manetheren."
The tufts went down again.
"There was a very fine grove there. Your pain sings in my heart, Randalthor. We could not come in time."
Loyal bowed where he sat, and Rand bowed back. He suspected Loyal would be hurt if he did not, would think he was rude at the very least. He wondered if Loyal thought he had the same sort of memories the Ogier seemed to. The corners of Loyal's mouth and eyes were certainly turned down, as if he were sharing the pain of Rand's loss, just as if the destruction of Manetheren were not something that happened 2,000 years ago, near enough, something that Rand only knew about because of Moraine's story. After a time, Loyal sighed.
"The wheel turns," he said, "and no one knows it's turning. But you have come almost as far from your home as I have. A very considerable distance, as things are now. When the ways were freely open, of course, but that is long past. Tell me what brings you so far. Is there something you want to see, too?"
Rand opened his mouth to say that they had come to see the false dragon, and he could not say it. Perhaps it was because Loyal acted as if he were no older than Rand, 90 years old or no 90 years old. Maybe for an Ogier, 90 years was not any older than he was. It had been a long time since he had been able to really talk to anyone about what was happening. Always the fear that they might be dark friends or think he was. Matt was so drawn in on himself, feeding his fears on his own suspicions, that he was no good for talking. Rand found himself telling Loyal about Winternight. Not a vague story about dark friends,
The truth about Trolloc's breaking in the door and a fade in the quarry road. Part of him was horrified at what he was doing, but it was almost as if he were two people, one trying to hold his tongue while the other only felt the relief at being able to tell it all finally. The result was that he stumbled and stuttered and jumped around in the story, Shadar Logoth and losing his friends in the night, not knowing if they were alive or dead, the fade in Whitebridge and Tom dying so they could escape, the fade in Bearlon, dark friends later, Howell Goad, and the boy who was afraid of them and the woman who tried to kill Matt, the half-man outside the Goose and Crown. When he started babbling about dreams, even the part of him that wanted to talk felt the hackles rising on the back of his neck. He bit his tongue, clamping his teeth shut. Breathing heavily through his nose, he watched the Ogier warily, hoping he thought he had meant nightmares. The light knew it all sounded like a nightmare, or enough to give anyone nightmares. Maybe Loyal would just think he was going mad. Maybe...
Tavirin, Loyal said.
Rand blinked. What?
Tavirin.
Loyal rubbed behind a pointed ear with one blunt finger and gave a little shrug.
Elder Haman always said I never listened, but sometimes I did. Sometimes I listened. You know how the pattern is woven, of course.
I never really thought about it, he said slowly. It just is.
Yes, well, not exactly. You see, the Wheel of Time weaves the pattern of the ages, and the threads it uses are lives. It is not fixed, the pattern, not always. If a man tries to change the direction of his life and the pattern has room for it, the wheel just weaves on and takes it in. There is always room for small changes, but sometimes the pattern simply won't accept a big change, no matter how hard you try. You understand?
Rand nodded. I could live on the farm or in Emmons Field, and that would be a small change. If I wanted to be a king, though... He laughed, and Loyal gave a grin that almost split his face in two. His teeth were white and as broad as chisels.
Yes, that's it. But sometimes the change chooses you, or the wheel chooses it for you. And sometimes the wheel bends a life thread or several threads in such a way that all the surrounding threads are forced to swirl around it. And those force other threads, and those still others, and on and on. That first bending to make the web, that is Tavirin. And there is nothing you can do to change it, not until the pattern itself changes. The web, Tomorrow Island, it's called, can last for weeks or for years. It can take in a town or even the whole pattern. Arthur Hawkwing was Tavirin. So was Luz Theron Kinslayer, for that matter, I suppose.
He let out a booming chuckle.
Elder Haman would be proud of me. He always droned on, and the books about traveling were much more interesting. But I did listen sometimes.
That's all very well, Rand said, but I don't see what it has to do with me. I'm a shepherd, not another Arthur Hawkwing. And neither is Matt or Perrin. It's just... ridiculous.
I didn't say you were, but I could almost feel the pattern swirl just listening to you tell your tale, and I have no talent there. You are Tavirin, all right. You and maybe your friends, too.
The Ogier paused, rubbing the bridge of his nose thoughtfully. Finally he nodded to himself as if he had reached a decision.
I wish to travel with you, Rand.
For a minute, Rand stared, wondering if he had heard correctly.
"With me?" he exclaimed when he could speak. "Did you hear what I said about—"
He eyed the door suddenly. It was shut tight and thick enough that anyone trying to listen on the other side would hear only a murmur, even with his ear pressed against the wooden panels. Just the same, he went on in a lower voice.
"About who's chasing me? Anyway, I thought you wanted to see your trees."
This book continues on the other side of this cassette. Cassette 15, Side 2.
Just the same, he went on in a lower voice.
About who's chasing me? Anyway, I thought you wanted to see your trees.
There is a very fine grove at Tarvalin, and I have been told the Aes Sedai keep it well tended. Besides, it is not just the groves I want to see. Perhaps you are not another Arthur Hawkwing, but for a time at least part of the world will shape itself around you. Perhaps is even now shaping itself around you. Even Elder Haman would want to see that.
Rand hesitated. It would be good to have someone else along. The way Matt was behaving, being with him was almost like being alone. The Ogier was a comforting presence. Maybe he was young as Ogier reckoned age, but he seemed as unflappable as a rock, just like Tam. And Loyal had been to all of those places and knew about others. He looked at the Ogier sitting there with his broad face a picture of patience. Sitting there, and taller sitting than most men standing. How do you hide somebody almost 10 feet tall? He sighed and shook his head. I don't think that is a good idea, Loyal. Even if Moraine finds us here, we'll be in danger all the way to Tar Valon. If she does not... If she doesn't, then she's dead and so is everyone else.
Oh, Egwene...
He gave himself a shake. Egwene was not dead, and Moraine would find them. Loyal looked at him sympathetically and touched his shoulder.
I am sure your friends are well, Rand.
Rand nodded his thanks. His throat was too tight to speak.
Will you at least talk with me sometimes? Loyal sighed, a bass rumble. And perhaps play a game of stones? I have not had anyone to talk to in days, except good Master Gil, and he is busy most of the time. The cook seems to run him unmercifully. Perhaps she really owns the inn?
Of course I will.
His voice was hoarse. He cleared his throat and tried to grin. And if we meet in Tar Valon, you can show me the grove there. They have to be all right. Light Sen, they're all right.
Chapter 37. The Long Chase. Nynaeve gripped the reins of the three horses and peered into the night as if she could somehow pierce the darkness and find the Aes Sedai and the warder. Skeletal trees surrounded her, stark and black in the dim moonlight. The trees and the night made an effective screen for whatever Moiraine and Lan were doing, not that either of them had paused to let her know what that was. A low, "Keep the horses quiet," from Lan, and they were gone, leaving her standing like a stable boy. She glanced at the horses and sighed with exasperation. Mandar blended into the night almost as well as his master's cloak. The only reason the battle-trained stallion was letting her get this close was because Lan had handed her the reins himself. He seemed calm enough now, but she remembered all too well the lips drawing back silently when she reached for his bridle without waiting for Lan's approval. The silence had made the bared teeth seem that much more dangerous. With a last wary look at the stallion, she turned to peer in the direction the other two had gone, idly stroking her own horse. She gave a startled jump when Aldib pushed a pale muzzle under her hand, but after a minute she gave the white mare a pat, too. "No need to take it out on you, I suppose," she whispered, "just because your mistress is a cold-faced..." She strained at the darkness again. What were they doing? After leaving Whitebridge, they had ridden through villages that seemed unreal in their normality, ordinary market villages that seemed to Nynaeve unconnected to a world that had fades and trollocs and Aes Sedai. They had followed the Camelin Road until at last Moiraine sat forward in Aldib's saddle, peering eastward as if she could see the whole length of the great highway, all the many miles to Camelin, and see, too, what waited there. Eventually the Aes Sedai let out a long breath and settled back. "The wheel weaves as the wheel wills," she murmured, "but I cannot believe it weaves an end to hope. I must first take care of that of which I can be certain. It will be as the wheel weaves." And she turned her mare north, off the road into the forest. One of the boys was in that direction with the coin Moiraine had given him. Lan followed. Nynaeve gave a long last look at the Camelin Road. Few people shared the roadway with them there, a couple of high-wheeled carts and one empty wagon in the distance, a handful of folk afoot with their belongings on their backs, or piled on push-carts. Some of those were willing to admit they were on their way to Camelin to see the false dragon, but most denied it vehemently, especially those who had come through Whitebridge. At Whitebridge she had begun to believe Moiraine, somewhat, more at any rate, and there was no comfort in that. The warder and the Aes Sedai were almost out of sight through the trees before she started after them. She hurried to catch up. Lan looked back at her frequently and waved for her to come on, but he kept at Moiraine's shoulder, and the Aes Sedai had her eyes fixed ahead. One evening after they left the road, the invisible trail failed. Moiraine, the unflappable Moiraine, suddenly stood up beside the small fire where the tea kettle was boiling, her eyes widening. "It is gone," she whispered at the night. "He is..." Nynaeve could not finish the question. "Light. I don't even know which one it is." "He did not die," the Aes Sedai said slowly. "But he no longer has the token." She sat down, her voice level and her hand steady as she took the kettle off the flames and tossed in a handful of tea. "In the morning we will keep on as we've been going. When I get close enough, I can find him without the coin." As the fire burned down to coals, Lan rolled himself in his cloak and went to sleep. Nynaeve could not sleep. She watched the Aes Sedai. Moiraine had her eyes closed, but she sat upright, and Nynaeve knew she was awake. Long after the last glow had faded from the coals, Moiraine opened her eyes and looked at her. She could feel the Aes Sedai's smile even in the dark. "He has regained the coin, Wisdom. All will be well." She lay down on her blankets with a sigh, and almost at once was breathing deep in slumber. Nynaeve had a hard time joining her, tired as she was. Her mind conjured up the worst, no matter how she tried to stop it. All will be well. After Whitebridge, she could no longer make herself believe that so easily. Abruptly, Nynaeve was jerked from memory back to the night. There really was a hand on her arm. Stifling the cry that rose in her throat, she fumbled for the knife at her belt, her hand closing on the hilt before she realized that the hand was Lan's. The warder's hood was thrown back, but his chameleon-like cloak blended so well with the night that the dim blur of his face seemed to hang suspended in the night. The hand on her arm appeared to come out of thin air. She drew a shuddering breath. She expected him to comment on how easily he had come on her unaware, but instead he turned to dig into his saddlebags. "You are needed," he said, and knelt to fasten hobbles on the horses. As soon as the horses were secured, he straightened, grasped her hand, and headed off into the night again. His dark hair fit into the night almost as well as his cloak, and he made even less noise than she did. Grudgingly, she had to admit that she could never have followed him through the darkness without his grip as a guide. She was not certain she could pull loose if he did not want to release her anyway. He had very strong hands. As they came up on a small rise, barely enough to be called a hill, he sank to one knee, pulling her down beside him. It took her a moment to see that Moiraine was there, too. Unmoving, the Aes Sedai could have passed for a shadow in her dark cloak. Lan gestured down the hillside to a large clearing in the trees. Nynaeve frowned in the dim moonlight, then suddenly smiled in understanding. Those pale blurs were tents in regular rows, a darkened encampment. "White cloaks," Lan whispered. 200 of them, maybe more. There's good water down there, and the lad we're after." "In the camp?" She felt more than saw Lan nod. "In the middle of it. Moiraine can point right to him. I went close enough to see he's under guard." "A prisoner?" Nynaeve said. "Why?" "I don't know. The children should not be interested in a village boy. Not unless there was something to make them suspicious. The light knows it doesn't take much to make white cloaks suspicious, but it still worries me." "How are you going to free him?" It was not until he glanced at her that she realized how much assurance there had been in her that he could march into the middle of 200 men and come back with the boy. "Well, he is a warder. Some of the stories must be true." She wondered if he was laughing at her, but his voice was flat and businesslike. "I can bring him out, but he'll likely be in no shape for stealth. If we're seen, we may find 200 white cloaks on our heels and us riding double, unless they are too busy to chase us. Are you willing to take a chance?" "To help an Emmons fielder? Of course. What kind of chance?" He pointed into the darkness again, beyond the tents. This time she could make out nothing but shadows. They're horse lines. If the picket ropes are cut, not all the way through, but enough so they'll break when Warain creates a diversion, the White Cloaks will be too busy chasing their own horses to come after us. There are two guards on that side of the camp, beyond the picket lines, but if you are half as good as I think you are, they'll never see you. She swallowed hard. Stalking rabbits was one thing. Guards, though, with spears and swords. So he thinks I'm good, does he? I'll do it. Lan nodded again as if he had expected no less. One other thing. There are wolves about tonight. I saw two, and if I saw that many, there are probably more. He paused, and though his voice did not change, she had the feeling he was puzzled. It was almost as if they wanted me to see them. Anyway, they shouldn't bother you. Wolves usually stay away from people. I wouldn't have known that, she said sweetly. I only grew up around shepherds. He grunted, and she smiled into the darkness. We'll do it now, then, he said. Her smile faded as she peered down at the camp full of armed men. 200 men with spears and swords, and before she could reconsider, she eased her knife in its sheath and started to slip away. Moiraine caught her arm in a grip almost as strong as Lan's. Take care, the Aes Sedai said softly. Once you cut the ropes, return as quickly as you can. You are a part of the pattern, too, and I would not risk you, any more than any of the others if the whole world was not at risk in these days. Nynaeve rubbed her arm surreptitiously when Moiraine released it. She was not about to let the Aes Sedai know the grip had hurt. But Moiraine turned back to watching the camp below as soon as she let go. And the warder was gone, Nynaeve realized with a start. She had not heard him leave. Light blind the bloody man. Quickly she tied her skirts up to give her legs freedom and hurried into the night. After that first rush with fallen branches cracking under her feet, she slowed down, glad there was no one there to see her blush. The idea was to be quiet, and she was not in any kind of competition with the warder. Oh, no? She shook off the thought and concentrated on making her way through the dark woods. It was not hard, in and of itself. The faint light of the waning moon was more than enough for anyone who had been taught by her father, and the ground had a slow, easy roll. But the trees, bare and stark against the night sky, constantly reminded her that this was no childhood game, and the keening wind sounded all too much like trollic horns. Now that she was alone in the darkness, she remembered that the wolves that usually ran away from people had been behaving differently in the two rivers this winter. Relief flooded through her like warmth when she finally caught the smell of horses. Almost holding her breath, she got down on her stomach and crawled upwind toward the smell. She was nearly on the guards before she saw them, marching toward her out of the night, white cloaks flapping in the wind and almost shining in the moonlight. They might as well have carried torches. Torchlight could not have made them much more visible. She froze, trying to make herself a part of the ground. Nearly in front of her, not 10 paces away, they marched to a halt with a stomp of feet, facing each other, spears shouldered. Just beyond them she could make out shadows that had to be the horses. The stable smell, horse and manure, was strong. All is well with the night, one white-cloaked shape announced. The light illumine us and protect us from the shadow. All is well with the night, the other replied. The light illumine us and protect us from the shadow. With that they turned and marched off into the darkness again. Nynaeve waited, counting to herself while they made their circuit twice. Each time they took exactly the same count, and each time they rigidly repeated the same formula, not a word more or less. Neither so much as glanced to one side. They stared straight ahead as they marched up, then marched away. She wondered if they would have noticed her even if she had been standing up. Before the night swallowed the pale swirl of their cloaks a third time, she was already on her feet, running in a crouch toward the horses. As she came close, she slowed so as not to startle the animals. The white cloak guards might not see what was not shoved under their noses, but they would certainly investigate if the horses suddenly began whickering. The horses along the picket lines, there was more than one row, were barely realized masses in the darkness, heads down. Occasionally one snorted or stamped a foot in its sleep. In the dim moonlight she was nearly on the end post of the picket line before she saw it. She reached for the picket line and froze when the nearest horse raised its head and looked at her. Its single lead rein was tied in a big loop around the thumb-thick line that ended at the post. One whinny. Her heart tried to pound its way out of her chest, sounding loud enough to bring the guards. Never taking her eyes off the horse, she sliced at the picket rope, feeling in front of her blade to see how far she had cut. The horse tossed its head, and her breath went cold. Just one whinny. Only a few thin strands of hemp remained whole under her fingers. Slowly she headed toward the next line, watching the horse until she could no longer see if it was looking at her or not, then drew a ragged breath. If they were all like that, she did not think she would last. At the next picket rope, though, and the next, the horses remained asleep, even when she cut her thumb and bit off a yelp. Sucking the cut, she looked warily back the way she had come. Upwind as she was, she could no longer hear the guards make their exchange, but they might have heard her if they were in the right place. If they were coming to see what the noise had been, the wind would keep her from hearing them until they were right on top of her. Time to go. With four horses out of five running loose, they won't be chasing anyone. But she did not move. She could imagine Lan's eyes when he heard what she had done. There would be no accusation in them. Her reasoning was sound, and he would not expect any more of her. She was a wisdom, not a bloody great invincible warder who could make himself all but invisible. Jaw set, she moved to the last picket line. The first horse on it was Bella. There was no mistaking that squat, shaggy shape. For there to be another horse like that, here and now, was too big a coincidence. Suddenly she was so glad that she had not left off this last line that she was shaking. Her arms and legs trembled so that she was afraid to touch the picket rope, but her mind was as clear as the wine spring water. Whichever of the boys was in the camp, Egwene was there too, and if they left riding double, some of the children would catch them no matter how well the horses were scattered, and some of them would die. She was as certain as if she were listening to the wind. That stuck a spike of fear into her belly, fear of how she was certain. This had nothing to do with weather or crops or sickness. Why did Moiraine tell me I can use the power? Why couldn't she leave me alone? Strangely, the fear stilled her trembling. With hands as steady as if she were grinding herbs in her own house, she slit the picket rope as she had the others. Thrusting the dagger back into its sheath, she untied Bella's lead rein. The shaggy mare woke with a start, tossing her head, but Nynaeve stroked her nose and spoke comforting words softly in her ear. Bella gave a low snort and seemed content. Other horses along that line were awake, too, and looking at her. Remembering Mandarb, she reached hesitantly to the next lead rein, but that horse gave no objection to a strange hand. Indeed, it seemed to want some of the muzzle-stroking that Bella had received. She gripped Bella's rein tightly and wrapped the other around her other wrist, all the while watching the camp nervously. The pale tents were only 30 yards off, and she could see men moving among them. If they noticed the horses stirring and came to see what caused it... Desperately, she wished for Moiraine not to wait on her return. Whatever the Aes Sedai was going to do, let her do it now. Light, make her do it now, before... Abruptly, lightning shattered the night overhead, for a moment obliterating darkness. Thunder smote her ears, so hard she thought her knees would buckle, as a jagged trident stabbed the ground just beyond the horses, splashing dirt and rocks like a fountain. The crash of riven earth fought the thunderstroke. The horses went mad, screaming and rearing. The picket ropes snapped like thread where she had cut them. Another lightning bolt sliced down before the image of the first faded. Nynaeve was too busy to exult. At the first clash, Bella jerked one way while the other horse reared away in the opposite direction. She thought her arms were being pulled out of their sockets. For an endless minute she hung suspended between the horses, her feet off the ground, her scream flattened by the second crash. Again the lightning struck, and again, in one continuous raging roar from the heavens. balked in the way they wanted to go, the horses surged back, letting her drop. She wanted to crouch on the ground and soothe her tortured shoulders, but there was no time. Bella and the other horse buffeted her, eyes rolling wildly till only whites showed, threatening to knock her down and trample her. Somehow she made her arms lift, clutched her hands in Bella's mane, pulled herself onto the heaving mare's back. The other rein was still around her wrist, pulled tight into the flesh. Her jaw dropped as a long gray shadow snarled past, seeming to ignore her and the horses with her, but teeth snapping at the crazed animals now darting in every direction. A second shadow of death followed close behind. Nynaeve wanted to scream again, but nothing came out. Wolves? Light help us! What is Moiraine doing? The heels she dug into Bella's sides were not needed. The mare ran, and the other was more than happy to follow. Anywhere, so long as they could run, so long as they could escape the fire from the sky that killed the night.
Chapter 38 Rescue. Perrin shifted as best he could with his wrists bound behind him, and finally gave up with a sigh. Every rock he avoided brought him two more. Awkwardly, he tried to work his cloak back over him. The night was cold, and the ground seemed to draw all the heat out of him, as it had every night since the white cloaks took them. The children did not think prisoners needed blankets or shelter, especially not dangerous dark friends. Egwene lay huddled against his back for warmth, sleeping the deep sleep of exhaustion. She never even murmured at his shifting. The sun was long hours below the horizon, and he ached from head to foot after a day of walking behind a horse with a halter around his neck, but sleep would not come for him. The column did not move that fast. With most of their remounts lost to the wolves in the steading, the white cloaks could not push on as hard as they wanted. The delay was another thing they held against the Emmonsfielders. The sinuous double line did move steadily, though. Lord Bornhold meant to reach Camelin in time for whatever it was, and always in the back of Perrin's mind was the fear that if he fell, the white cloak holding his leash would not stop, no matter Lord Captain Bornhold's orders to keep them alive for the questioners in Amador. He knew he could not save himself if that happened. The only times they freed his hands were when he was fed and for visits to the latrine pit. The halter made every step momentous, every rock underfoot potentially fatal. He walked with muscles tense, scanning the ground with anxious eyes. Whenever he glanced at Egwene, she was doing the same. When she met his eyes, her face was tight and frightened. Neither of them dared take their eyes off the ground long enough for more than a glance. Usually he collapsed like a wrung-out rag as soon as the white cloaks let him stop, but tonight his mind was racing. His skin crawled with dread that had been building for days. If he closed his eyes, he would see only the things Bayar promised for them once they reached Amador. He was sure Egwene still did not believe what Bayar told them in that flat voice. If she did, she would not be able to sleep no matter how tired she was. In the beginning, he had not believed Bayar either. He still did not want to. People just did not do things like that to other people. But Bayar did not really threaten. As if he were talking about getting a drink, he talked about hot irons and pincers, about knives slicing away skin and needles piercing. He did not appear to be trying to frighten them. There was never even a touch of gloating in his eyes. He just did not care if they were frightened or not, if they were tortured or not, if they were alive or not. That was what brought cold sweat to Perrin's face once it got through to him. That was what finally convinced him Bayar was telling the simple truth. The two guards' cloaks gleamed grayly in the faint moonlight. He could not make out their faces, but he knew they were watching. As if they could try something, tied hand and foot the way they were. From when there had still been light enough to see, he remembered the disgust in their eyes and the pinched looks on their faces, as though they had been set to guard filth-soaked monsters, stinking and repellent to look at. All the white cloaks looked at them that way. It never changed. Light. How do I make them believe we aren't dark friends when they're already convinced we are? His stomach twisted sickeningly. In the end, he would probably confess to anything just to make the questioners stop. Someone was coming, a white cloak carrying a lantern. The man stopped to speak with the guards, who answered respectfully. Perrin could not hear what was said, but he recognized the tall, gaunt shape.
He squinted as the lantern was held close to his face. Bayar had Perrin's axe in his other hand. He had appropriated the weapon as his own. At least, Perrin never saw him without it. "Wake up," Bayar said, emotionlessly, as if he thought Perrin slept with his head raised. He accompanied the words with a heavy kick in the ribs. Perrin gave a grunt through gritted teeth. His sides were a mass of bruises already from Bayar's boots. "I said wake up." The foot went back again, and Perrin spoke quickly.
"I'm awake."
You had to acknowledge what Bayar said, or he found ways to get your attention. Bayar set the lantern on the ground and bent to check his bonds. The man jerked roughly at his wrist, twisting his arms in their sockets. Finding those knots still as tight as he had left them, Bayar pulled at his ankle rope, scraping him across the rocky ground. The man looked too skeletal to have any strength, but Perrin might as well have been a child. It was a nightly routine. As Bayar straightened, Perrin saw that Egwene was still asleep.
"Wake up!" he shouted. "Egwene, wake up!"
"What? What?"
Egwene's voice was frightened and still thick with sleep. She lifted her head, blinking in the lantern light. Bayar gave no sign of disappointment at not being able to kick her awake. He never did. He jerked at her ropes the same way he had Perrin's, ignoring her groans. Causing pain was another of those things that seemed not to affect him one way or another. Perrin was the only one he really went out of his way to hurt. Even if Perrin could not remember it, Bayar remembered that he had killed two of the children. "Why should dark friends sleep?" Bayar said dispassionately, "when decent men must stay awake to guard them."
"For the 100th time, Egwene said wearily, "we aren't dark friends."
Perrin tensed. Sometimes such a denial brought a lecture delivered in a grating near monotone on confession and repentance, leading into a description of the questioner's methods of obtaining them. Sometimes it brought the lecture and a kick. To his surprise, this time Bayar ignored it. Instead, the man squatted in front of him, all angles and sunken hollows, with the axe across his knees. The golden sun on his cloak's left breast and the two golden stars beneath it glittered in the lantern light. Taking off his helmet, he set it beside the lantern. For a change, there was something besides disdain or hatred on his face, something intent and unreadable. He rested his arms on the axe handle and studied Perrin silently. Perrin tried not to shift under that hollow-eyed stare.
"You're slowing us down, dark friend, you and your wolves. The Council of the Anointed has heard reports of such things, and they want to know more. So you must be taken to Amador and given to the questioners. But you are slowing us down. I had hoped we could move fast enough even without the remounts, but I was wrong."
He fell silent, frowning at them. Perrin waited. Bayar would tell him when he was ready.
"The Lord Captain is caught in the cleft of a dilemma," Bayar said finally. "Because of the wolves, he must take you to the council. But he must reach Camelin, too. We have no spare horses to carry you, but if we continue to let you walk, we will not reach Camelin by the appointed time. The Lord Captain sees his duties with a single-minded vision, and he intends to see you before the council."
Egwene made a sound. Bayar was staring at Perrin, and he stared back, almost afraid to blink.
"I don't understand," he said slowly. "There is nothing to understand," Bayar replied. "Nothing but idle speculation. If you escaped, we would not have time to track you down. We don't have an hour to spare if we are to reach Camelin in time. If you frayed your ropes on a sharp rock, say, and vanished into the night, the Lord Captain's problem would be solved."
Never taking his gaze from Perrin, he reached under his cloak and tossed something on the ground. Automatically, Perrin's eyes followed it. When he realized what it was, he gasped. A rock. A split rock with a sharp edge.
"Just idle speculation," Bayar said. "Your guards tonight also speculate."
Perrin's mouth was suddenly dry.
"Think it through. Light help me think it through, and don't make any mistakes."
Could it be true? Could the White Cloak's need to get to Camelin quickly be important enough for this? Letting suspected dark friends escape?
There was no use trying that way. He did not know enough. Baya was the only white cloak who had talked to them, aside from Lord Captain Bornhold, and neither was exactly free with information. Another way. If Baya wanted them to escape, why not simply cut their bonds? If Baya wanted them to escape. Baya, who was convinced to his marrow that they were Dark Friends. Baya, who hated Dark Friends worse than he did the Dark One himself. Baiar, who looked for any excuse to cause him pain because he had killed two white cloaks. Baiar wanted them to escape? If he had thought his mind was racing before, now it sped like an avalanche. Despite the cold, sweat ran down his face in rivulets. He glanced at the guards. They were only shadows of pale gray, but it seemed to him that they were poised, waiting. If he and Egwene were killed trying to escape and their ropes had been cut on a rock that could have been lying there by chance, the Lord Captain's dilemma would be solved, all right, and Baya would have them dead the way he wanted. The gaunt man picked up his helmet from beside the lantern and started to stand.
"Wait,"
Perrin said hoarsely. His thoughts tumbled over and over as he searched in vain for some way out.
"Wait. I want to talk. I...
help comes." The thought blossomed in his mind, a clear burst of light in the midst of chaos, so startling that for a moment he forgot everything else, even where he was. Dapple was alive. "Elias?" he thought at the wolf, demanding without words to know if the man was alive. An image came back. Elias lying on a bed of evergreen branches beside a small fire in a cave, tending a wound in his side. It all took only an instant. He gaped at Baya, and his face broke into a foolish grin. Elias was alive. Dapple was alive. Help was coming. Baya paused, risen only to a crouch, looking at him.
"Some thought has come to you, Perrin of the Two Rivers, and I would know what it is."
For a moment, Perrin thought he meant the thought from Dapple. Panic fled across his face, followed by relief. Baya could not possibly know. Baya watched his changes of expression, and for the first time the white cloak's eyes went to the rock he had tossed on the ground. He was reconsidering, Perrin realized. If he changed his mind about the rock, would he dare risk leaving them alive to talk? Ropes could be frayed after the people wearing them were dead, even if it made for risk of discovery. He looked into Baya's eyes. The shadowed hollows of the man's eye sockets made them appear to stare at him from dark caves. And he saw death decided. Baya opened his mouth, and as Perrin waited for sentence to be pronounced, things began to happen too fast for thought. Suddenly one of the guards vanished. One minute there were two dim shapes, the next the night swallowed one of them. The second guard turned, the beginning of a cry on his lips, but before the first syllable was uttered there was a solid ka-chunk, and he toppled over like a felled tree. Baya spun, swift as a striking viper, the axe whirling in his hands so fast that it hummed. Perrin's eyes bulged as the night seemed to flow into the lantern light. His mouth opened to yell, but his throat locked tight with fear. For an instant, he even forgot that Baya wanted to kill them. The white cloak was another human being, and the night had come alive to take them all. Then the darkness invading the light became Lan, cloak swirling through shades of gray and black as he moved. The axe in Baya's hand lashed out like lightning, and Lan seemed to lean casually aside, letting the blade pass so close he must have felt the wind of it. Baya's eyes widened as the force of his blow carried him off balance, as the warder struck him with hands and feet in rapid succession, so quick that Perrin was not sure what he had just seen. What he was sure of was Baya collapsing like a puppet. Before the falling white cloak had finished settling to the ground, the warder was on his knees extinguishing the lantern. In the sudden return to darkness, Perrin stared blindly. Lan seemed to have vanished again.
"Is it really?"
Egwene gave a stifled sob.
"We thought you were dead. We thought you were all dead."
"Not yet." The warder's deep whisper was tinged with amusement. Hands touched Perrin, found his bonds. A knife sliced through the ropes with barely a tug, and he was free. Aching muscles protested as he sat up. Rubbing his wrists, he peered at the graying mound that marked Baya.
Is he?
No, Lan's voice answered quietly from the darkness.
I do not kill unless I mean to. But he won't bother anyone for a while. Stop asking questions and get a pair of their cloaks. We do not have much time.
Perrin crawled to where Byar lay. It took an effort to touch the man, and when he felt the white cloak's chest rising and falling, he almost jerked his hands away. His skin crawled as he made himself unfasten the white cloak and pull it off. Despite what Lan said, he could imagine the skull-faced man suddenly rearing up. Hastily he fumbled around till he found his axe, then crawled to another guard. It seemed strange at first that he felt no reluctance to touch this unconscious man, but the reason came to him. All the white cloaks hated him, but that was a human emotion. Byar felt nothing beyond that he should die. There was no hate in it, no emotion at all. Gathering the two cloaks in his arms, he turned, and panic grabbed him. In the darkness, he suddenly had no sense of direction, of how to find his way back to Lan and the others. His feet rooted to the ground, afraid to move. Even Byar was hidden by the night without his white cloak. There was nothing by which to orient himself. Any way he went might be out into the camp.
Here.
He stumbled toward Lan's whisper until hands stopped him. Egwene was a dim shadow and Lan's face was a blur. The rest of the warder seemed not to be there at all. He could feel their eyes on him, and he wondered if he should explain.
Put on the cloaks, Lan said softly. Quickly. Bundle your own, and make no sound. You aren't safe yet.
Hurriedly, Perrin passed one of the cloaks to Egwene, relieved at being safe from having to tell of his fear. He made his own cloak into a bundle to carry, and swung the white cloak around his shoulders in its place. He felt a prickle as it settled around his shoulders, a stab of worry between his shoulder blades. Was it Byar's cloak he had ended up with? He almost thought he could smell the gaunt man on it. Lan directed them to hold hands, and Perrin gripped his axe in one hand and Egwene's hand with the other, wishing the warder would get on with their escape so he could stop his imagination from running wild. But they just stood there, surrounded by the tents of the children, two shapes in white cloaks and one that was sensed but not seen.
Soon, Lan whispered. Very soon.
Lightning broke the night above the camp, so close that Perrin felt the hair on his arms, his head lifting as the bolt charged the air. Just beyond the tents, the earth erupted from the blow, the explosion on the ground merging with that in the sky. Before the light faded, Lan was leading them forward. At their first step, another strike sliced open the blackness. Lightning came like hail, so that the night flickered as if the darkness were coming in momentary flashes. Thunder drummed wildly, one roar rumbling into the next, one continuous, rippling peal. Fear-stricken horses screamed, their whinnies drowned except for moments when the thunder faded. Men tumbled out of their tents, some in their white cloaks, some only half-clothed, some dashing to and fro, some standing as if stunned. Through the middle of it, Lan pulled them at a trot, Perrin bringing up the rear. White cloaks looked at them, wild-eyed, as they passed. A few shouted at them, the shouts lost in the pounding from the heavens, but with their white cloaks gathered around them, no one tried to stop them. Through the tents, out of the camp, and into the night, and no one raised a hand against them. The ground turned uneven under Perrin's feet, and brush slapped at him as he let himself be drawn along. The lightning flickered fitfully and was gone. Echoes of thunder rolled across the sky before they, too, faded away. Perrin looked over his shoulder. A handful of fires burned back there, among the tents. Some of the lightning must have struck home, or perhaps men had knocked over lamps in their panic. Men still shouted, voices tiny in the night, trying to restore order, to find out what had happened. The land began to slope upwards, and tents and fires and shouting were left behind. Suddenly he almost trod on Egwene's heels as Lan stopped. Ahead in the moonlight stood three horses. A shadow stirred, and Moraine's voice came, weighted with irritation.
Nynaeve has not returned. I fear that young woman has done something foolish.
Lan spun on his heel as if to return the way they had come, but a single whip-crack word from Moraine halted him.
No.
He stood looking at her sideways, only his face and hands truly visible, and they but dimly shadowed blurs. She went on in a gentler tone, gentler but no less firm.
Some things are more important than others, you know that.
The warder did not move, and her voice hardened again.
Remember your oaths, Alan Mandragoran, Lord of the Seven Towers. What of the oath of a diademed battle lord of the Malkyrie?
Perrin blinked. Lan was all of that? Egwene was murmuring, but he could not take his eyes off the tableau in front of him. Lan standing like a wolf from Dapple's pack, a wolf at bay before the diminutive Aes Sedai, and vainly seeking escape from doom. The frozen scene was broken by a crash of breaking branches in the woods. In two long strides, Lan was between Moraine and the sound, the pale moonlight rippling along his sword. To the crackle and snap of underbrush, a pair of horses burst from the trees, one with a rider.
"Bella!"
Egwene exclaimed at the same time that Nynaeve said from the shaggy mare's back,
"I almost didn't find you again. Egwene, thank the light you're alive."
She slid down off Bella, but as she started toward the Emmonsfielders, Lan caught her arm and she stopped short, staring up at him.
"We must go, Lan,"
Moraine said, once more sounding unruffled, and the warder released his grip. Nynaeve rubbed her arm as she hurried to hug Egwene, but Perrin thought he heard her give a low laugh, too. It puzzled him because he did not think it had anything to do with her happiness at seeing them again.
"Where are Rand and Matt?"
he asked.
"Elsewhere,"
Moraine replied, and Nynaeve muttered something in a sharp tone that made Egwene gasp. Perrin blinked. He had caught the edge of a wagoneer's oath and a coarse one.
"The lights send they are well,"
the Aes Sedai went on, as if she had not noticed.
"We will none of us be well," Lan said, "if the white cloaks find us. Change your cloaks and get mounted."
Perrin scrambled up onto the horse Nynaeve had brought behind Bella. The lack of a saddle did not hamper him. He did not ride often at home, but when he did, it was more likely bareback than not. He still carried the white cloak, now rolled up and tied to his belt. The warder said they must leave no more traces for the children to find than they could help. He still thought he could smell byre on it. As they started out, the warder leading on his tall black stallion, Perrin felt Dapple's touch on his mind once more.
One day again.
More a feeling than words, it sighed with the promise of a meeting foreordained, with anticipation of what was to come, with resignation to what was to come, all streaked in layers. He tried to ask when and why, fumbling in his haste and sudden fear. The trace of the wolves grew fainter, fading. His frantic questions brought only the same heavy-laden answer.
One day again.
It hung haunting in his mind long after awareness of the wolves winked out. Lan pressed southward slowly but steadily. The night-draped wilderness, all rolling ground and underbrush hidden until it was underfoot, shadowed trees thick against the sky, allowed no great speed in any case. Twice the warder left them, riding back toward the slivered moon, he and Mondar becoming one with the night behind. Both times he returned to report no sign of pursuit. Egwene stayed close beside Nynaeve. Soft-spoken scraps of excited talk floated back to Perrin. Those two were as buoyed up as if they had found home again. He hung back at the tail of their little column. Sometimes the wisdom turned in her saddle to look back at him, and each time he gave her a wave as if to say that he was all right, and stayed where he was. He had a lot to think about, though he could not get any of it straight in his head.
What was to come? What was to come?
Perrin thought it could not be much short of dawn when Moraine finally called a halt. Lan found a gully where he could build a fire hidden within a hollow in one of the banks. Finally, they were allowed to rid themselves of the white cloaks, burying them in a hole dug near the fire. As he was about to toss in the cloak he had used, the embroidered golden sun on the breast caught his eye, and the two golden stars beneath. He dropped the cloak as if it stung and walked away, scrubbing his hands on his coat, to sit alone.
"Now,"
Egwene said, once Lan was shoveling dirt into the hole,
"will somebody tell me where Rand and Matt are?" "I believe they are in Camelon,"
Moraine said carefully,
"or on their way there."
Nynaeve gave a loud, disparaging grunt, but the Aes Sedai went on as if she had not been interrupted.
"If they are not, I will yet find them. That I promise."
They made a quiet meal on bread and cheese and hot tea. Even Egwene's enthusiasm succumbed to weariness. The wisdom produced an ointment from her bag for the wheals the ropes had left on Egwene's wrists, and a different one for her other bruises. When she came to where Perrin sat on the edge of the firelight, he did not look up. She stood looking at him silently for a time, then squatted with her bag beside her, saying briskly,
"Take your coat and shirt off, Perrin.
They tell me one of the White Cloaks took a dislike to you.
He complied slowly, still half lost in Dapple's message, until Nynaeve gasped. Startled, he stared at her, then at his own bare chest. It was a mass of color. The newer purple blotches, overlaying older ones, faded into shades of brown and yellow. Only thick slabs of muscle earned by hours at Master Luhan's forge had saved him from broken ribs. With his mind filled by the wolves, he had managed to forget the pain. But he was reminded of it now, and it came back gladly. Involuntarily, he took a deep breath and clamped his lips on a groan.
"How could he have disliked you so much?" Nynaeve asked wonderingly. "I killed two men."
Aloud, he said,
"I don't know."
She rummaged in her bag, and he flinched when she began spreading a greasy ointment over his bruises.
"Ground ivy, five finger, and sunburst root," she said.
It was hot and cold at the same time, making him shiver while he broke into a sweat. But he did not protest. He had had experience of Nynaeve's ointments and poultices before. As her fingers gently rubbed the mixture in, the heat and cold vanished, taking the pain with them. The purple splotches faded to brown, and the brown and yellow paled, some disappearing altogether. Experimentally, he took a deep breath. There was barely a twinge.
"You look surprised," Nynaeve said.
She looked a little surprised herself and strangely frightened.
"Next time you can go to her."
"Not surprised," he said soothingly. "Just glad."
Sometimes Nynaeve's ointments worked fast and sometimes slow, but they always worked.
What happened to Rand and Matt?"
Nynaeve began stuffing her vials and pots back into her bag, jamming each one in as if she were thrusting it through a barrier.
"She says they're all right. She says we'll find them. In Camelin, she says. She says it's too important for us not to, whatever that means. She says a great many things."
Perrin grinned in spite of himself. Whatever else had changed, the wisdom was still herself, and she and the Aes Sedai were still far from fast friends. Abruptly, Nynaeve stiffened, staring at his face. Dropping her bag, she pressed the backs of her hands to his cheeks and forehead. He tried to pull back, but she caught his head in both hands and thumbed back his eyelids, peering into his eyes and muttering to herself. Despite her small size, she held his face easily. It was never easy to get away from Nynaeve when she did not want you to.
"I don't understand," she said finally, releasing him and settling back to sit on her heels. "If it was yellow eye fever, you wouldn't be able to stand. But you don't have any fever, and the whites of your eyes aren't yellowed, just the irises." "Yellow," Moraine said,
and Perrin and Nynaeve both jumped where they sat. The Aes Sedai's approach had been utterly silent. Egwene was asleep by the fire, wrapped in her cloaks, Perrin saw. His own eyelids wanted to slide closed.
"It isn't anything," he said. But Moraine put a hand under his chin and turned his face up so she could peer into his